but last night, an attempt was made on her life. By an ace, I'm sad to say. Jack Braun saved her, and would have died himself if I hadn't taken a hand.
I saw the highlights on TV, Jay said.
The man Braun fought fits Digger's description of Mackie Messer.
It sounds like the same man, Hiram said.
That doesn't prove he was actually working for Greg.
But I suppose... He gave a long, deep sigh of resignation, like a man being forced to accept something he could not stomach. I suppose I must take this all seriously.
Very well, then.
For a moment he sounded like the old Hiram. Decisive, full of resolve.
I'll take you to Dr. Tachyon. He can perform the necessary blood test, and if need be, he can go into Hartman's mind and find the truth. Whatever that truth may be.
On the table, his fingers opened and closed, opened and closed. Hiram stared down at them, grimaced, forced his hand to relax.
So much is at stake, he said. Jay, if we're wrong, think of all the people we'll hurt.
And if we're right, Jay asked quietly. Hiram seemed to shrink in on himself.
If we're right, Hiram said softly. God help us all.
Ever seen anything like this before? Brennan asked Tripod, putting the mysterious note down on the bar, careful to avoid the wetness seeping out from under the Joker's beer mug. Tripod bent down close to the bar to get a good look at it and shook his head.
Nope,
he said. Great. Squisher's basement was still packed with a lunch crowd. Squisher himself was floating contentedly in his aquarium. He waved a long, boneless arm at Brennan and whistled in a shrill, piping voice.
Hey, big guy. Long time no see. Who's the babe?
Brennan glanced at Jennifer. Friend of mine.
Hey, Squisher said. We should all be so lucky.
He winked his huge staring eye and smiled leeringly.
Free drinks for my pals,
he ordered the bartender. Thanks, Brennan said. He remembered the quality of their whiskey. I'll have a beer, he told the mouthless bartender, who was staring at him and Jennifer fixedly.
White wine,
Jennifer said, and the bartender continued to stare.
I'll have a beer, too.
Right,
he rasped through the small hole cut at the base of his throat. Find a table, Brennan told Jennifer and Tripod, where we can talk things over. They pushed off into the crowd. He waited for their drinks, nodded thanks to the bartender, then took them over to a small, isolated corner table. He put the drinks down. Tripod took a long sip of beer through a straw.
So, where'd you get that note, Mr. Y?
He asked. Brennan told him between sips of beer. Tripod shook his head after Brennan's story.
You got me baffled.
Me too, Brennan admitted. It's obvious that we're being watched, but by who?
Besides Lazy Dragon?
Tripod asked. Brennan nodded. He certainly hasn't been leaving notes. He's been watching us for fade out.
Well,
Tripod said,
I'll keep an eye out. Any other leads to follow?
We've eliminated Bludgeon, Oddity, and Worm, Brennan said. Doug Morkel and Quasiman seem unlikely, but there's still two inconsistencies. Two things that still don't add up.
Can't, Jennifer said. He investigated Azili Rouge and said that she was clean. That's not exactly what you told us.
That's right, Brennan said. And Sasha. He's still missing. He must know more about the murder than he told me at his mother's.
And he's also connected with Azili,
Jennifer added. Right, Brennan said.
Kant should be easy enough to find, Jennifer said. I'll check with Fort Freak and see where he is.
She came back from the phone in less than a minute and sat down, shaking her head.
He didn't report in this morning. No one at the station knows where he is.
Bingo,
Tripod said. Brennan stood up, smiling grimly. I hope we can get to him before he disappears too.
Try Freakers, Tripod suggested. That's his favorite hangout. I'll circulate. Someone will know where he is.
Right, Brennan said. He turned to Jennifer. You wait at Freakers for him. Don't approach him if you spot him. Just keep him under surveillance. I'm going to try Sasha's mother's place. She might know where her son is. If she doesn't open up, maybe I'll ask Father Squid to talk to her. He's not exactly Russian Orthodox, but he is a priest. They all headed for the door. Squisher rose out of his aquarium and stopped them with a shrill whistle.
Hey, pal, he said to Brennan. You got something I can put on our celebrity wall?
He gestured toward a section of wall near the aquarium that Brennan hadn't noticed before. Tacked up on it was an amazing array of junk, from an autographed photo of a queasily smiling Tachyon standing next to Squisher's aquarium with one of the Joker's boneless arms draped around his shoulders, to a lacy handkerchief stained with green ichor, and a pair of crushless panties with spaces for two crotches. Brennan reached into his pocket for an ace of spades. Will this do?
Sure, Squisher said. Say, can you make it out to my good pal, Squisher?
3 p.m. Jay could hear the voices through the door, shouting. Maybe we ought to come back later, Hiram said weakly. I don't think this is a good time. There's no good time for shit like this, Jay told him. He knocked loudly. Silence fell inside. A moment later, the door to the suite was flung open. Dr. Tachyon gave them both a look like they were the last two people in the world he wanted to see right now. The little alien was ragged and weary. He had scratch marks on his face and a puffy split lip. Wordless, he looked at them for a long moment, then stepped back to let them enter. Hiram moved heavily across the room, brushed aside the drapes, stared blindly out into the Atlanta heat. A teenage boy with painfully bright red hair was looking at Jay curiously. Aykroyd sat on the couch, the garment bag across his lap. No one seemed to want to speak, so Jay had to do it. Lose the kid, he told Tachyon. The boy protested. Hey! Blaze, go, said Tachyon in a tone that brooked no arguments.
I thought I'd forfeited the right.
Go, damn you.
Shit, just when things were getting interesting.
Blaze held up his hands, palms out.
Hey, no problem, I'm gone.
When the door banged shut, the quiet fell again. Tachyon made an exasperated gesture. Hiram, what the devil is this? Jay answered. You gotta run a blood test, Doc. Right now. Tachyon looked about.
What? Here?
Don't be dense, and don't be cute, Jay told him. I'm too fucking tired, and I hurt too much to deal with it. He unzipped the garment bag, dragged out the rag that so much blood had been shed on, for and over. This is Senator Hartman's jacket from Syria. Tachyon looked at the bloodstain as if it might leap off the jacket and devour him.
How did you come to possess this?
He asked, in a voice thickened by fear. Jay sighed. That's a long story, and none of us had the time. Let's just say I got it from Chrysalis. It was, well, sort of a legacy. Nervously clearing his throat, Tack asked, And just what do you think I'm going to find? The presence of xenovirus Tacus A, Jay said. The alien stumbled across the room like a zombie and made himself a drink. Jay could have used one too, but none were being offered. I see a jacket, Tachyon said when he was well fortified. Anyone could buy a jacket. Doctor it with virus positive blood. Hiram finally spoke up. That's what I thought, but he's been through too much. The link from Syria to this hotel room is clear. It's Hartman's jacket. Tachyon turned to look at Hiram. Do you want me to do this thing? Do we have any choice? No, said Tachyon with vast weariness. I don't suppose we have.
4 p.m. Mrs. Starfin was polite in a cold, gracious way. She offered Brennan tea, but no new information on her missing son. Just as Brennan was about to leave the apartment, the phone rang. Mrs. Starfin answered it and gestured to Brennan.
It's for you,
she said. He took it, more than a little surprised. It had to be either Jennifer or Tripod, because they were the only two who knew that he was here. It was Tripod.
Yeoman,
he said.
I've got something for you.
What is it? Tripod's voice was rougher than usual.
I can't talk over the phone. Meet me at the marina off Beaumont on the south shore of Sheepshead Bay.
All right, Brennan said. See you there. Brennan hung up and bade goodbye to Mrs. Starfin, who was not sorry to see him go. He couldn't get Tripod's tone of voice out of his mind. It sounded as if he'd discovered something bad. Perhaps, Brennan thought, Sasha's body? That would explain his reluctance to discuss his discovery in detail over the phone. The Beaumont Marina was new and rather high class. The ships tied in at the various slips were all rich man crafts, not the skiffs of the casual weekend sailor. Brennan prowled among the slips for several minutes before he noticed a Tripod standing alone at the end of a dock, looking out over the bay. Brennan hustled over to him. What's up? He asked. Tripod turned to him. His face was battered and bruised.
Sorry, Mr. Y, he said. They made me make the call.
He nodded down at the boat tied into the dock's last slip. It was a sleek twin-engine yacht with the name Asian Princess stenciled on the side. Worm was standing there with a grin on his reptilian face, showing lots of teeth. He was accompanied by two immaculate egrets and a huge joker. The joker had normal, if thick, legs, but from the waist up had two torsos, two pairs of shoulders and arms, and two heads. He seemed vaguely familiar. Brennan realized he'd seen him among the crowd at Squishers. He must have squealed to Worm about Tripod.
There he is,
one of the heads said with satisfaction.
I told you he'd come.
You were right, Brick,
Worm said, still smiling.
I'm Mick,
the head said. He jerked a thumb at his other head.
That's Rick. He didn't want to do this. I did too, the other head answered. No, you didn't. You were scared. Was not, was too, was.
All right,
Worm said loudly, interrupting the squabbling heads.
Here.
He proffered a roll of bills, which a hand belonging to Mick snatched before Rick could.
That's mine,
Rick protested.
Mine too,
Mick said.
I helped beat up the armless geek.
Enough, Worm said. His good humor quickly turned to exasperation. He said to Brennan,
You embarrassed me in front of Sui Ma, he said. Now it's payback time. Join us on deck, won't you? You too,
he said to Tripod. The egrets had their guns out, so Brennan wasn't about to argue with Worm. He steadied Tripod as the Joker stepped onto the gently rocking boat, then followed him onto the deck. What do you want? Brennan asked his old foe. Worm's eyes gleamed with returned good humor.
Just a swimming contest. We're going to see if you can swim Sheepshead Bay, way down by those.
He pointed at a pair of chains with lead weights attached, then turned to the egrets.
Tie them up.
The egrets did so quickly and efficiently, while Worm covered them and Rick and Mick chatted inanely. When they were trussed up to Worm's satisfaction, he ordered the egrets to take them down into the cabin for safekeeping, while Worm went to the control console to pilot the ship into deep water. Rick and Mick went to cast off the line.
Sorry,
Tripod said again as they shuffled into the cabin. Brennan's hands and legs and Tripod's legs had been bound with rope, but the weighted chains hadn't been added yet. Brennan shrugged. There wasn't anything you could do. The cabin was plush and expensive-looking, complete with luxurious sofa, deep pile carpeting, and a wet bar. How about a drink? Brennan suggested, after Worm started the engines and the princess pulled away from his slip. One of the egrets laughed. You don't want a drink before going into the water, he said. Stomach cramps. I ain't going to be swimming this afternoon, though. Brennan turned to Tripod. He's probably right, he said. You can't be too careful when it comes to boats. He swung his bound hands at the closest egret and caught him square in the throat, crushing his windpipe. As he went down choking, the other egret whirled, reaching for the gun he put down while pouring a shot of scotch. Brennan shuffled forward, crashing into him shoulder first, and they both fell to the floor. The egret opened his mouth to yell, and Tripod fell on his head, muffling his screams. Brennan picked up the egret's gun clumsily, with both hands and rammed it against his chest. He pulled the trigger, and the egret jerked once and was still. The other was crawling about the cabin, making mewling sounds as he gasped for breath. Brennan caught up with him and clubbed him down with the barrel of the pistol, not wanting to risk alerting the others on deck with another shot. Tripod took a deep breath.
I knew you'd get us out of this,
he said in a relieved voice. We're not out of it yet, Brennan said. Tripod rolled over to where Brennan was sitting on the floor, leaning against the cabin's plush sofa.
We will be in a minute.
His dexterous third foot was free. He quickly untied Brennan, who returned the favor.
What do we do now?
Tripod asked. How about trying our hands at piracy? They crept onto the deck. Worm was at the wheel. Rick and Mick were arguing. Worm said exasperatedly,
Well, if Rick thought he heard something below, you should go check it out.
No need, Brennan said. Startled, they turned to see Brennan standing there pointing a gun at them. Worm hissed in hate and frustration. Rick and Mick looked at each other.
I told you we shouldn't get involved,
Mick said. For once, Rick said nothing. Brennan glanced at the boat's position. They were nearing the middle of the bay, and there were no other boats in the vicinity. Time for the swimming contest, he said. He gestured Worm away from the wheel with his gun. For a moment, the Joker hesitated, but then he moved. You're lucky, Brennan said in a hard voice, that I decided to dispense with the chains. Over you go. Worm looked like he wanted to say something, then thought better of it, and swallowed his exit line. He went over the edge without a word. Brennan turned to Rick and Mick.
Hey, Mick said. I didn't want to have anything to do with this.
You're just a victim of the company you keep, Brennan suggested.
That's right. Rick's a bad influence.
Jump or die, Brennan said. It makes no difference to me. Rick and Mick looked at each other, nodded, and leapt over the side of the ship. They made a big splash when they hit the water. Tripod let out a deep sigh of relief.
You know, Mr. Y, I think I need some time off.
A vacation would probably be in order, Brennan said as he took the wheel. Know anybody who buys boats? Tripod brightened.
There's this guy in Jersey.
6 p.m. It was 100 times more complex than a snowflake, delicate as the finest lace, like a flower made of ice. Jay stared at the image on the screen of the electron microscope for a long time. Jesus, he said, releasing the breath he hadn't even realized he'd been holding. It's beautiful. Tachyon pushed back his long red hair. Yes, I suppose it is. Trust us Takesians to create a virus to match our aesthetic ideal. He pivoted on the lab stool and suddenly yelled out, Aykroyd! Jay turned just as Hiram started to go down in a faint. He grabbed one arm, tacked the other. Hiram's weight brought them all down with a thump. On the floor, the huge ace ran a hand across his face and said, Sorry. Must have blacked out for an instant. Tack gave him a hit from a pocket flask, and Hiram sucked it down greedily. Jay suddenly realized how thirsty he was. Hey, can I have a sip of that? It's been a hell of a week. Tack handed it to him wordlessly, and Jay tried to swallow. Brandy. Well, it was better than nothing. There can be no doubt, Hiram was asking. None. But just because he's an ace, well, that proves nothing. He'd have been mad to admit to the virus. He might be a latent. Tachyon stared up at the ceiling. He looked lost. Jay broke the silence. So what do we do now? A very good question, Tachyon said. You mean you don't know? Contrary to popular belief, I do not have the solution to every problem. Hiram struggled to his feet ponderously. We got to have more proof than this, he said. Jay jerked a thumb at the fancy microscope. What more proof do you want? We don't know if he's done anything wrong. He had Chrysalis killed, Jay said, rising to face him. I demand evidence of wrongdoing. Hiram whacked a closed fist into an open palm. Jay pointed at the screen.
That's evidence.
Stop it! Stop it!
Tachyon yelled. Hiram took the alien by the shoulders.
You go to him. Talk to him. There may be some logical explanation. Think of all the good he's done.
Oh, yeah, Jay said with all the sarcasm he could muster. He was sick and tired of hearing about St. Greg. He took another hit of brandy.
Think of what we stand to lose, Hiram cried.
Sometimes Hiram's innocence was unbearable.
So he'll just lie to Tachyon, Jay said. Where the hell does that get us?
He cannot lie to me, Tachyon announced portentously. Hiram took his hands away, and Tack straightened like a man trying to be tall. It didn't work very well.
If I go to him, you know what I will do, he told Hiram.
Will you accept the truth of what I read in his mind?
Yes, Worcester said.
Even though it is inadmissible in a court of law?
Yes.
Tachyon danced around to face Jay. As for you, Mr. Aykroyd, take the jacket. Destroy it.
Fleeting visions of the world of shit he'd lived through to find the jacket passed through Jay Aykroyd's mind, and he protested.
Hey, that's our only proof.
Proof? Are you really suggesting that we publicize this? Think. What we hold could spell the ruin of every wild card in America.
Stubbornly, Jay said.
But he killed Chrysalis, and if we don't nail him, Elmo takes the fall.
That was too much for the alien. All of a sudden, Tachyon started pulling at his hair in something that looked perilously close to a hysterical frenzy.
Damn you! Damn you! Damn you!
Look, it's not my fault, Jay said. Scared that Tack was about to burst into tears. But I'm damned if I'm going to agree to some sleazy little deal that lets Chrysalis's murderer walk.
I swear to you, upon my honor and blood, that I will not let Elmo suffer.
Yeah? What are you going to do?
I don't know yet.
Tachyon switched off the electron microscope, removed the slide, washed the incriminating scraps of fabric down the sink. Hiram moved to follow when the alien started to leave, but Tack stopped him.
No, Hiram. I must do this alone.
Jay pointed out the obvious objection.
And if he's got Buzzsaw Boy waiting for you?
He asked. That's the risk I must take.
7 p.m. It's all, Brennan told Jennifer grimly. Just a matter of patience. For what was perhaps the 10th time in the last hour, one of the Freaker's patrons cruised their table, eyeing Brennan and Jennifer speculatively. For the 10th time in the past hour, Brennan gave a cold stare and made the cruiser move on without lingering. But, he added through gritted teeth, I'm about all out. He'd made it back to Freaker's about an hour ago, and had told Jennifer about his nautical adventures and Tripod's wise decision to go on vacation in Florida until things quieted down. He'd had quite a bankroll to finance it, because Kien's Asian princess had brought a nice sum from Tripod's boat broker acquaintance, which they'd split 50-50. A cocktail waitress with a Medusa head of twitching blind worms came up to their table. We're waiting for someone, Brennan said. She smiled.
Someone in particular? She asked. Or will anyone do?
Brennan ground his teeth together. He started to answer her, stopped, and gripped Jennifer's arm while nodding toward the bar. Here, he said, giving the barmaid a 20 without looking at her. Go away. She took the bill, slipped it into her ample cleavage, and went off on her rounds.
It's him,
Jennifer whispered. Brennan nodded. Wait here. Kant was at the bar. Even from across the room, Brennan could see that he was highly agitated. He was questioning one of the bartenders as Brennan came up quietly behind him. The bartender was shaking his head.
She ain't been in for a couple of days.
Camp was disheveled and had a rank Reptile House smell about him.
You don't understand,
he told the bartender. I need her. I need the kiss.
The woman sitting at the bar swiveled toward him, her face hidden by a cheap, glittery mask.
You sound like you need it bad, doll.
Kent turned to her. His eyes were bloodshot. His breath was a husky rattle.
I'll kiss you, honey,
the woman said.
Anywhere you want.
Kent growled wordlessly and struck her backhanded across the face, knocking her from the bar stool. She gazed up at him in terror as he towered over her, glowering like a madman.
I don't need a filthy whore, he screamed.
He pounded his fist on the bar, then shuddered all over like a dog throwing off water. He brought himself under control with great effort and hissed,
I need the kiss.
He whirled and almost trampled Brennan as he lunged toward the door. No one tried to stop him. Brennan turned to signal Jennifer and saw that she was already at his side. He took his bowcase from her and said quietly,
Let's go.
It was the easiest tailing job Brennan had ever done. Cand left a trail of disgruntled pedestrians in his wake as he obliviously slammed through them. The biggest problem Brennan had was keeping up with him. Cant wasn't exactly running, but he was moving with the urgency of a man who had to find a bathroom. They followed him for half a dozen blocks to a shabby five-story apartment building. It was solid and functional-looking, with no pretense towards elegance or security. Cant went in the lobby, and after a moment, Brennan and Jennifer followed him. They heard him pound up the stairs and then followed at a more sedate pace all the way to the top, meeting no one else on the way. Brennan and Jennifer reached the top floor just in time to peer around the stairwell and see Kent take a key ring from his pocket and unlock the door. He entered the apartment and slammed the door so hard that it rattled in its frame.
He's off the deep end,
Brennan whispered. Jennifer nodded.
Let's find out why.
Brennan unzipped his bowcase and took out the long-barreled air pistol that had been snugged down next to the bow. It was loaded with tranquilizer darts. He didn't want to hurt Kent, and he wanted the Joker able to answer his questions. They went down the corridor and stopped in front of the door. It had rebounded out of its latch when Kent had slammed it, so that it was open a crack. Brennan nodded at Jennifer, who blew him a kiss, and then he went in fast and low, dropping the bowcase and rolling to a crouch. The living room was decorated with obvious expense, but it was not to Brennan's taste. It was brightly lit with numerous bulbs blazing in track lighting set in the ceiling, and even though it was summer, the heat was on and cranked up to the max. The furniture was all shiny leather and polished chrome. The image of a lizard sunning himself on a smooth rock flashed through Brennan's mind. The room was empty. Brennan closed the door as Jennifer ghosted through the wall and joined him. It was quiet but tense, as if an angry beast were waiting in ambush somewhere in the apartment. Brennan motioned down the hallway that led to the apartment's interior, and Jennifer nodded. He crept forward, passing a kitchenette that was also empty, then a hall closet whose sliding door was half open. Brennan looked into it to make sure it wasn't hiding a crazed Joker cop. It wasn't, so he moved on toward the doorway to the bedroom, listened for a moment, then cautiously peered in. The room was dominated by a huge four-poster waterbed with mirrors on the canopy and headboard. A big screen television stood against the wall opposite the bed. Next to the television was what looked like a child's wading pool filled with sand. A pair of sun lamps were focused on the pool, and Kent was in it, naked, with his eyes closed. He was rooting in the sand, mumbling aloud as he dragged himself through the grit, as if he were frenziedly trying to wipe himself clean.
Kent, Brennan said quietly. The Joker turned slowly. His face was a frozen mask of madness. There was an ugly oozing sore on his lower neck. He stared at Brennan, his mouth working wordlessly, and then he screamed and sprang, his hands outstretched, his fingers hooked into talons. Brennan calmly shot him. The pistol whooshed, and a feathered dart flew through the air, struck Kent's naked chest, and bounced off the hard, scaly skin. Shit, Brennan thought. Then the maniac was on him.
So close, Hiram said. He sighed hugely, got up from the couch, and went over to the wet bar to mix himself a drink.
They were in Tachyon's suite at the Marriott, waiting for his return and watching the convention on television. "Too damn close, if you ask me," Jay said. Down on the floor of the Omni, another inconclusive ballot had just been tallied. A wave of sympathy voting had pushed Greg Hartman to 1,956 votes of the 2,082 needed to nominate. Jackson and Dukakis had both lost support, and the tiny draft Cuomo movement had melted away entirely. Only the Barnett forces were holding firm. Hundreds of Hartman supporters, with victory so close they could taste it, were dancing in the aisles, waving their green and gold placards, chanting, "Hartman! Hartman!" over and over, while the chair gabbled for order. The convention floor was a sea of Hartman green and gold, surrounding a few stubborn islands of Jackson red, Dukakis blue, and Barnett white. David Brinkley had just predicted that Hartman would go over the top on the next ballot when one of Leo Barnett's people rose and moved to suspend the rules to allow the Reverend Leo Barnett to address the convention. All of a sudden, half of the hall was on its feet, screaming at the podium. The couch woofed in protest as Hiram sat back down. "Damn him," Hiram said. "But it's a good move. Barnett will never get to the floor, but we'll have to vote down the motion, and that will take time. It might cost us some momentum." "Us?" Jay said, with a sidelong glance. Hiram scowled, rubbing at the back of his neck under his collar. "Until I have proof that Greg is the monster you claim, I'm still a Hartman delegate. By rights, I ought to be there, right now." He looked at his watch. What could be taking Tachyon so long? Mackie Messer could be cutting his liver out, Jay thought, but he didn't say it. Hiram was in bad enough shape already. Jay was trying to figure out what their next move would be if Tachyon never came back from his little showdown with Hartman. And what if he came back and said Greggy was innocent? That would be enough for Hiram. But Jay was of a more suspicious nature. Could Hartman's ace powers be potent enough to twist even Tachyon to his will? Jay didn't think so. But he'd been wrong before. He was glad he'd ignored Tachyon's advice about the jacket. It was safely back in its garment bag, hanging in the closet. On the tube, Hartman's people asked for a voice vote on the motion to suspend the rules. Barnett's supporters objected, demanding a roll call vote. A Hartman delegate asked for a voice vote on the motion for a roll call vote. The chair stopped to consult the parliamentarian. Jay got up and changed the channel. The other networks were showing the same thing, as was CNN. But he found an old movie on Ted Turner's Superstation. Colorized, unfortunately. Cary Grant was a strange shade of pink. Jay left it on anyway. Hiram was annoyed. "Damn it, Popinjay," he said. "Put the convention back on." "Give me a break, Hiram," Jay said. "They're arguing about whether they ought to vote, about how to vote on whether some guy can give a speech." "Yes," Hiram snapped. "And it might just be crucial. If you want to see Topper so badly, just say so, and I'll buy you a cassette. George Kirby was never that color, dead or alive." Jay looked at him sharply. "What did you say?" "I said that George Kirby was never..." "Shit," Jay swore. "God damn it." "What is it?" Hiram said. He came ponderously to his feet. "Jay, are you all right?" "No," Jay said. "I'm dumb as a plank. George Kirby, George fucking Kirby. The assassin, Hiram. Chrysalis was being clever. The airline ticket was made out in the name George Kirby." Hiram Worcester was scarcely a slow man. "Tickets in the name of a ghost," he said. "Yeah," said Jay. "A ghost. A specter." "James Specter," Hiram said. "And both George Kirbys came back from the dead," Jay said. "She hired that son of a bitch, Demise." Hiram knew what Demise was capable of. "We have to let them know," he said.
He crossed the room, picked up the phone, and punched for the operator. Connect me to the Secret Service. The door opened. Dr. Tachyon stepped quietly into the room, head bowed. Hiram looked at him with dread. The telephone momentarily forgotten in his hand.
It's not true, is it?
He said desperately.
Tell me that it's all some hideous mistake. Greg can't be.
Tachyon looked up with pity in his lilac eyes. Hiram, the alien said softly. My poor, poor Hiram. I saw his mind. I saw the puppet man. The little man shuddered. It is 1,000 times worse than we could ever have imagined. Tachyon sat on the carpet, buried his head in his hands, and began to weep. Hiram stood there with his mouth open. Jay had never seen him look so used up, so beaten, so fat. He took the receiver away from his ear and stared at it, as if he'd never seen a telephone before, his face gray as ash. God forgive me, he said in a barely audible whisper. Then he hung up the phone.
It was Brennan's day for fighting lizards. Camp was strong, but in his frenzy he forgot whatever combat techniques he knew. Brennan blocked Kant's taloned hand as it raked at his eyes, caught the cop's other wrist, and flung him hard against the bed's footboard. Kant crouched, panting, and when Brennan leapt on him, he flicked open a switchblade he'd grabbed from the heap of clothes piled next to his sand pool. Brennan changed direction in mid-leap, but wasn't quite fast enough. The knife slashed open his t-shirt and the skin underneath, drawing a line of blood from belly button to nipple across Brennan's stomach and chest. Wraith walked out of the wall as Brennan flung himself to the other side of the bed. Kant saw her, and his eyes bugged out of his head. He twisted frantically from side to side, trying to watch both Jennifer and Brennan at the same time.
We're not going to hurt you, Jennifer said in her most soothing voice. We want to help.
Help me? Kant asked, his voice high-pitched, hysterical, and mean. If you want to help me, get me the goddamn kiss!
Brennan lunged across the bed, grabbed Kant's knife wrist, and yanked hard, pulling Kant down. The knife plunged into the mattress. Brennan leapt on him, and Kant twisted savagely, gutting the waterbed. Water spewed from it, as if a dam had broken. Brennan and Kant tumbled apart, and the cop washed up next to Jennifer, wet as a wharf rat, sputtering and spitting. He grabbed Jennifer, drew the knife back to slash. She ghosted. He swung through her, teetered off balance, and Brennan grabbed him from behind and rammed him through the screen of the television set. It exploded with a loud crash. Kant hung inside it, stunned, until Brennan pulled him out. The cop was dazed and bleeding from a dozen cuts on his face and chest. Brennan slapped the knife from his hand and kicked it away, then pushed him down and sat on his chest.
What's this about a kiss? Brennan asked.
Kant moaned, unconsciously licking the blood that ran from his nose and lips.
Is it Azili? Do you want her?
Kant tossed his head from side to side. His eyes were stunned and glazed, but there was still a powerful need in them.
No! He howled. That bitch!
What then? Brennan demanded, shaking Kant by the shoulders.
The master! T. Malice! His kiss! So sweet! So sweet!
Brennan and Jennifer exchanged baffled glances. Who's Malice?
My master!
Brennan suddenly remembered where he'd seen a sore like the one on Kant's neck.
Is he Sasha's master, too?
Kant shook his head, still dazed and bewildered, and Brennan slapped him to get his attention.
Sasha, the bartender of the Crystal Palace, is Malice his master, too?
Yes.
Where are they?
I don't fucking know. They're gone. They left me behind.
Who did your master take with him?
Some mounts, Kant mumbled. I don't know them all.
Did he take Sasha?
Kant sobbed wordlessly, uncontrollably.
Christ, Brennan said.
He stood and dragged Kant to the bed. He took the pair of cuffs he found among Kant's clothes, piled on the floor, and chained the cop to a bedpost. Kant crouched in a puddle on the floor, weeping,
and picking at the sore on his neck. Brennan took the phone on the nightstand by the bed and dialed Fort Freak.
Mazarik, he said. This is an emergency, life or death.
It took the detective only a moment to answer.
This better be good,
he said, his voice harsh and flat.
It's your partner, Brennan said. He's strung out.
There was a shocked silence.
Drugs?
Mazarik asked after a moment. I don't think so. Look, Brennan said, cutting off more questions. I think you better get to Kent's apartment, fast. He needs help.
And Mazarik, what?
You owe me. He hung up the phone and turned to Wraith. Let's get the hell out of here.
What are we going to do? Hiram asked, when Tachyon's sobbing had finally begun to subside. Blow the whistle, Jay said. Dr. Tachyon bounced to his feet. No, he said. Are you mad, Ackroyd? The public must never learn the truth. Hartman's a monster, Jay objected. No one knows that better than I, said Tachyon. I swam in the sewer of his mind. I felt the vileness that lives inside him. The puppet man. It touched me. You can't imagine what that was like. I'm not a telepath, Jay said. So sue me. I'm still not going to help you whitewash Hartman. You do not understand, Tachyon said. For close to 2 years, Leo Barnett has been filling the public ear with dire warnings about wildcard violence, inflaming their fears and their mistrust of ACEs. Now you propose that we tell them that he was right all along, that a monstrous secret ACE has indeed subverted their government. How do you think they will react? Jay shrugged. He was too tired and beat up for intellectual discussions. Okay, so Barnett gets elected. Big deal. So we have a right-wing dork in the White House for 4 years. We managed to survive Reagan for 8. Dr. Tachyon was having none of it. You cannot know the half of what I found in Hartman's mind. The murders, the rapes, the atrocities, and him always at the center of his web. The puppet man pulling his strings. I warn you. If the full story ever becomes known, the public revulsion will touch off a reign of terror that will make the persecutions of the 50s look like nothing. The alien gesticulated wildly. He killed his own unborn child and feasted on the pain and terror of its death. And his puppets, aces, jokers, politicians, religious leaders, police, anyone foolish enough to touch him, if their names become known. Tachyon, Hiram Worcester interrupted. His voice was low, but the anguish in it was as plain as nails on a blackboard. Dr. Tachyon glanced guiltily at Hiram. It was hard to say which of them looked most frightened. Tell me, Hiram said. These puppets. Was I... One of... He couldn't finish, choking on the words. Tachyon nodded, a small, quick nod, almost furtive. A single tear rolled down his cheek. Then he turned away. Hiram considered that, his face leaden. Then he said, in a grotesque way, it's almost funny. But he did not laugh. Jay, he's right. This must be our secret. Jay looked from the tiny man to the big one, feeling outnumbered. Do what you want, he said. Just don't expect me to vote for the fucker, even if I was registered. We must take a vow, Tachyon said. A solemn oath to do everything in our power to stop Hartman and to take this secret to our graves. Oh, give me a break, Jay groaned. The last thing he needed right now was more Takesian bullshit. Hiram, that glass, the alien snapped. Hiram handed him the half-finished drink. and Tachyon upended the contents onto the carpet. He bent, slid a long knife out of a sheath in his boot, and held it up in front of them. "We must pledge by blood and bone," he said. And before anyone could stop him, the Takesian took the knife in his right hand and slashed straight across his left wrist. He held the wound over the glass until there was an inch of blood on the bottom, then bound his wrist in a lace hanky and passed the knife to Jay. Jay just looked at it. "You gotta be kidding." "No," Tachyon said. Face solemn. "How about I just piss in it instead?" Jay suggested. "The blood is the bond," Tachyon insisted. Hiram stepped forward. "I'll do it," he said, taking the knife. He shrugged out of his white linen coat, rolled up his sleeve, and made the cut. The pain made him inhale sharply, but his hand did not hesitate. "So deep," Tachyon muttered, as bright, hot blood began to spurt from Hiram's wrist. Hiram winced and held his hand above the glass. The red line crept upward. Then they were both looking at him. Jay sighed deeply. "So if you two are Huck and Tom, I guess that makes me Nigger Jim," he said. "Remind me to have my head examined when all of this is over." He took the knife. It hurt like a motherfucker. When it was done, Dr. Tachyon swirled the glass to mix the blood, then lifted it above his head and chanted in a high sing-song that Jay had to assume was Takesian. "By blood and bone, I so vow," he finished. He threw back his head and drained a third of the glass in one long gulp. Jay thought he was going to be sick. Even Hiram looked a little queasy as Tachyon passed him the glass. "By blood and bone," Hiram intoned, and took his ritual swallow. "Am I allowed to add some Tabasco, maybe a little vodka?" Jay asked when Hiram gave him what was left. "You are not," Tachyon said stiffly. "Pity," Jay said. "Always liked Bloody Marys." He lifted the glass, muttered, "Blood and bone," and drank the last of the blood, feeling like an idiot. "Yum," he said afterward. "It is done," Tachyon said. "Now we must make plans." "I'm going back to the Omni," Hiram announced. "I was among Greg's earliest supporters, and I dare say I'm not without influence in the New York delegation. I may be able to have some impact. We must deny him the nomination at all costs." "Agreed," said Tachyon. "I wish I knew more about Dukakis," Hiram began. "Not Dukakis," the alien said. "Jesse Jackson. He has been courting us all along. I'll speak to him." He clasped hands with Hiram, bloody hankies dangling down absurdly from their wrists. "We can do it, my friend." "Real good," Jay said. "So Greggy doesn't get to be president. Big deal. What about all his victims? Kahina, Chrysalis, the rest of them?" Dr. Tachyon glanced over. "Not Chrysalis," he said.
"What?"
Jay said. "He threatened Chrysalis, yes," the alien said. "He made her and Digger watch while his creature tortured and killed Kahina, but he never acted on that threat. When he heard of her death on Monday morning, he was as surprised as anyone." "No fucking way," Jay said. "You got it wrong." The little man pulled himself up to his full height. "I am a Psylord of Takis, trained by the finest mentats of House Ilkazam," he said. "His mind was mine. I did not get it wrong."
"He sent Mackie after Digger," Jay argued.
"And he commanded the oddity to retrieve the incriminating jacket and destroy it. Most assuredly, after he heard that Chrysalis was dead, he took steps to protect himself. But he had no hand in ordering that death. Tachyon put a hand on Jay's shoulder. I'm sorry, my friend.
Then who the fuck did it? Jay demanded.
We have no time to argue about this now, Hiram said impatiently.
The woman's dead. Nothing will...
Quiet, Jay said urgently. A news flash had banished Cary Grant from the television screen. Latest tragedy to strike the convention, a solemn announcer was saying. Senator Hartman is unharmed, repeat, unharmed, but reliable reports indicate that the ace assassin took the lives of two other men in his attempt to reach the senator. We are still waiting for final confirmation, but unofficial sources indicate that the killer's victims were Alex James, a Secret Service agent assigned to Senator Hartman. A photograph of the dead man appeared on the screen, above the announcer's shoulder, and the chairman of Hartman's California delegation, Ace Jack Braun. The controversial Braun, who starred in feature films and TV's Tarzan, was better known as Golden Boy. He was considered by some to be the strongest man in the world. Braun first came to public attention. Braun's picture appeared on screen as the announcer went on and on. He was in his old fatigues, smiling crookedly, surrounded by a golden glow. He looked young, alive, invincible. Oh, Jack, Tachyon said. He looked like he was going to cry again.
He can't be dead,
Hiram said furiously.
I just saved his damnable life last night.
The television set floated off the carpet, bobbing up toward the ceiling like a balloon. Jay glanced over and saw that Hiram's hand was squeezed into a fist.
He cannot be dead,
Hiram insisted. And all of a sudden the TV was falling. It hit the ground as if it had been dropped 6 stories instead of 6 feet. And the picture tube exploded. He will not have died in vain, Tachyon said inanely. He touched Hiram on the arm. Come, he said. After they had gone, Jay sat down on the couch. His ribs hurt, his face hurt, and now his wrist hurt, too. His mouth tasted like blood. He no longer had the remotest idea who the fuck could have killed Chrysalis, and he was too damn tired to think straight. He fumbled the bottle of painkillers out of his pocket, put 4 of them into his mouth, and washed them down with a good long swallow of Dr. Tachyon's best brandy. It tasted pretty damn good. The second swallow tasted even better. The third was downright delicious. After that, he lost count. By the time the decanter was empty, Jay's head was swimming. He lay down on the couch. No way he could sleep with all this going on. But maybe if he just closed his eyes for a few minutes.
8 p.m. After the long, hard day, Jennifer slept, but Brennan could not. He was on the edge of exhaustion, but his head felt curiously clear and light. His brain wouldn't shut off and allow him the rest he needed, so he slipped quietly out of bed, dressed, and went out into the night. It was hot and sticky. The heat wave smothering the city was unrelenting, even at night. The streets were full of people, wandering, Brennan thought, in a nameless search for answers to their own particular problems, answers as elusive as those Brennan was seeking. A new variable had shown up to further complicate the equation of Chrysalis's murder, the mysterious master T. Malice, and his apparent accomplice, Azili Rouge. Sasha was his servant, and so was Kant. The cop had used a strange term to refer to those in thrall to Malice. He had called them mounts. Brennan couldn't even begin to guess what that meant. A crowd had gathered in front of an all-night drugstore a few blocks from the hotel. Brennan joined them, curious as to what caused their hushed expectancy, and saw that the television set in the window was tuned to a news channel that was recapitulating the day's chaotic events in Atlanta. Jack Braun had been murdered, the newscaster said. Brennan couldn't believe it. When he was young, Brennan had been a big fan of Golden Boy, idolizing him because he was handsome, strong, and fearless. He was everything a hero should be. He sheltered the weak and protected the helpless as a living embodiment of the heroic ideal. As Brennan had gotten older, he learned that heroes could be hollow when he realized that Golden Boy had betrayed his friends in a moment of weakness and fear.
but his continuing belief in the heroic ideal had been part of what had drawn him to the military. There, Brennan had learned firsthand how difficult it was for ideals to flourish in an imperfect world. He'd been sent to defend Vietnam. Instead, because of inefficiency and incompetence, avarice and stupidity, he'd helped devastate it. Then those in charge of the mess just walked away, leaving the Vietnamese people in the hands of the murderous thugs they'd sworn to defend them from. Stung by the pain of that lesson, Brennan had walked away himself, had tried to isolate himself by abandoning the rest of humanity. But he discovered that old ties, always remembered, are impossible to forget, and new ties, once forged, are impossible to ignore. Let Barnett and Hardman, Brennan thought, play their games in Atlanta. Let them hoist placards, wear funny hats, and make speeches full of empty, impossible promises. In the end, they could do little that would matter. Despite his fine intentions and noble vows, Hardman would still be constrained by a system crippled by incompetence, inertia, and injustice. Barnett, too, would face the same roadblocks if he ever tried to put his despicable plans into operation. In the end, Brennan thought, it came down to protecting your comrades, your friends, and your family. Brennan knew he would always be ready for that. And if, as with Chrysalis, he was too late to protect, he would make sure that anyone who harmed his people once would never do so again. Brennan smiled wryly. Noble sentiments, he thought, but actually he wasn't getting very far in exacting retribution. Brennan stared unseeingly at the television screen. He needed more information, but his sources had all dried up. There was nothing on the street. Sasha had disappeared, perhaps under orders from the mysterious Malice. Fadeout was obviously more interested in using Brennan to get rid of Kian and to help find Chrysalis's files. Perhaps that was the answer. Chrysalis knew everything that went on in Jokertown. Perhaps her information cache had the answers Brennan needed, but the files were well hidden. Knowing how fond she was of secrets, Brennan doubted that she told anyone where she kept them. Except perhaps for one man. One man who was something of her confidant. One man whose lips would be sealed by unbreakable vows of silence. One man who had received a strange bequest from her. The time had come, Brennan decided, to call in all debts. His mind made up, Brennan turned back to his hotel room and a few hours' sleep. He smiled as the cat following him also turned, darting quickly through the shadows. He considered stopping and offering him a lift, but decided that Lazy Dragon could use the exercise.
Saturday, July 23rd, 1988. 8 a.m. Walked faster, his feet bare and bloody, rushing after the heavy man in the bulky black coat. He shouted after him, but nothing broke the dreadful silence but the sound of his feet. The steps grew narrow, making it harder to keep his balance as he rushed down into the darkness. When he reached the platform suspended over that Stygian gulf, the man was there ahead of him. Just the sight of that back, hunched and ominous, filled him with fear. And when the man began to turn, the terror rose inside him until he thought he would choke. The featureless white face lifted. The wet red tentacle tasted the air. Its howl and Jay's scream sounded together in a horrible cacophony.
"You beast your pants," a voice sneered. "Some ace."
Jay sat up. His suit was rumpled, his side ached, and his head was pounding. Some kid was standing across the room with a smirk on his face, like Jay was the funniest thing he'd ever seen. The kid had a refined, prissy little face, a French accent, and an attitude. His hair was so red it hurt to look at it. Jay wanted to pop him to the South Bronx, but he figured he better not. Groggy as he was, he seemed to recall that this was Tachyon's grandson. "Where's Gramps?" Jay asked as he lurched to his feet, ignoring the boy's jibes. There was broken glass all over the carpet. It crunched when he stepped on it. It was all over the couch, too, and a few shards fell off Jay when he stood. He noticed the shattered windows for the first time. When the hell had that happened? The kid shrugged.
"His bed wasn't slept in," he said. Maybe he finally caught one of East Bimbo's.
Figures, Jay said. I pass out on a goddamn couch with a perfectly adequate bed empty in the next room. He went over to the bar, glass breaking under his heels, and stared at the booze for a moment, until he found an unopened bottle of cognac. A little hair of the dog, he decided. Real good.
You're popping, Jay.
The kid was as arrogant as Tachyon. Not to mention almost as tall. Jay Aykroyd, Jay corrected. So who are you? Kid Tachyon?
Blaze. I am one quarter Tachyon,
he added proudly. Don't let it bother you. I'm one quarter Croat myself. Jay tossed back the cognac. It burned against the back of his throat on the way down. He splashed a little more into his glass and kept splashing. The glass was one-third full, one-half, three-quarters. Jay tried to put down the bottle. He kept pouring, filled the glass to the brim, poured it over his head. The liquor stung when it hit his eyes, blinding him. He tried to say, son of a bitch. Instead, he heard himself singing, I'm a little teapot, in a high falsetto voice, with all the little motions. Somewhere along there, the cognac glass slipped from his fingers and rolled across the carpet. When his vision cleared, Blaze was standing in front of him, arms crossed, smiling in satisfaction.
The Tachyons don't let anybody make fun of them, he told Jay. Watch what you say. I can make you do anything I like.
He laughed.
Now you're wet at both ends.
Real good, Jay said. He smelled like cognac and piss. You'd make some detective.
Really?
Blaze had managed to miss the sarcasm. Jay was grateful for that much.
No shit. Of course, you still got a few things to learn.
Like what? Blaze wanted to know.
Well, said Jay, like you really should make sure a guy is unarmed before you piss him off.
He made a gun of his hand, aimed it at Blaze, winked broadly. The boy was not impressed.
You're unarmed, he said.
Jay smiled sweetly. Blaze made a nice, crisp popping sound when he vanished. He didn't even have time to look surprised. Jay was standing there, with his finger pointing at empty air, when the door to the suite opened and a haggard-looking Dr. Tachyon walked in, saw him, and frowned. Doc, Jay said, trying to sound innocent.
I swear. I didn't know it was loaded.
9 a.m. Brennan entered the church and watched Quasiman for a few minutes as he watched the stained glass window that depicted the Passion of Jesus Christ, Joker. Hello, the Joker greeted Brennan cordially as Brennan approached, setting the butt of his long-handled squeegee on the floor and leaning on it as if it were a spear. I have to see Father Squid, Brennan said. Quasiman dropped the squeegee as the hand holding it suddenly vanished. He calmly looked down to where it had been, as if this was something he was used to. After a moment, Brennan felt a blast of cold air and caught a whiff of an unbearable stench, and Quasiman's hand was back. He leaned over and picked up the squeegee.
He's meditating in the chancellery,
Quasiman said, as if nothing out of the ordinary had occurred. Brennan nodded. I know the way. He moved to go by, but the Joker laid a hand on his forearm. It was still as cold as ice, but Quasiman either didn't notice or didn't care.
Do you know who did it yet?
He asked. Brennan shook his head.
Then you still may need me?
Quite possibly. Quasiman let go of Brennan's arm.
I'll be ready, he said, then added, I hope.
I hope so too, Brennan thought, but only nodded and went past. In the chancery, Father Squid was in his favorite meditative posture. Hello, Sergeant. The priest started. His eyes snapped open, and he looked up at Brennan. He smiled slightly, quivering the tendrils that hung down over his mouth. I could never have snuck up on you like that in the old days, Brennan said, sitting down across the desk from the priest. Father Squid nodded from the comfortable chair where he'd been dozing.
I'm older than I was in the old days. I also sleep a lot better.
Brennan smiled, though there was little humor in his expression. I did too, for a while.
Why don't you give it up and try to find the peace I have?
I tried, Brennan said. I even joined a monastery for a while. Zen monastery. He smiled at the look of astonishment on the priest's face. But I was never one of the better students. Violence follows me like an unwelcome shadow. I rarely seek it out, Father, but it finds me wherever I hide.
So we're back to Father, are we?
Brennan shrugged. Whatever you prefer. How many times did you make Sergeant anyway?
Father Squid smiled. 4 times.
And you were busted back to private each time.
Well, I wasn't one for following the rules back then.
Sometimes you had cause not to, Brennan said. The Joker Brigade was just an excuse to kill off as many of you as possible.
Maybe, but there were some good soldiers in it.
Father Squid smiled at Brennan.
And some of the units we served with weren't so bad. You never cared if a man had feathers, fur, or hair, or whether he had tentacles on his face and rows of suckers on his hands.
We were brothers in arms, Brennan said softly. That was all that mattered. They looked at each other for a long moment, reliving memories of 15 years gone by.
What did you do after the war?
Brennan finally asked.
Not much that I'm proud of. I sold my services for a while, but everywhere I went, as bad as it was in the Joker Brigade, as bad as Jokertown was back home, I found that Jokers were generally treated worse outside America.
He shrugged massive shoulders.
I tried to do something about it for a while, but I fear I actually did more harm than good.
I heard once, Brennan said, that a man called Squidface ran with the Black Dog. I wondered if it was you.
It was, the priest said heavily, and much do I regret those days. Never will I be able to do enough penance to cleanse my soul of the horror of the things I did in the name of my people.
Everyone makes mistakes, Brennan said quietly. The bad forget them. The good try to make up for them.
Well, the priest said, his nictitating membranes working quickly, I'm the one who should be offering spiritual comfort, my son.
Brennan smiled. Unlike you, I'm afraid that I may be beyond redemption. I could use your help with something else, though.
The murder.
Brennan nodded. I've hit a dead end. I've run out of clues, and I have no one to turn to. I realized last night that you were Chrysalis's confidant, maybe even her confessor. I remember the bequest she left you, and some whispers I'd heard about her secret files.
Father Squid shook his head. Her bequest was merely a suitcase full of money that she stashed away if she ever had to flee the city on short notice. It will do much to aid the poor of my parish, but little, I fear, to help track down her killer.
Brennan grimaced. And she never told you anything that might have a bearing on her death?
If she did, it was in the sanctity of confession and is an unshakable confidence that can never be broken.
Even if her murderer goes free?
The priest sighed heavily. Even if her murderer goes free.
Brennan stood, looked steadily at the priest. You have changed, he said. Sergeant Squidface knew when justice and honor took precedence over a rigid system of rules.
Sometimes, Captain, I despair of my soul. Sometimes I fear I am as poor a priest as you claim to have been a student of Zen.
Brennan suddenly smiled. Sometimes, Bob, I think we're both guilty of slinging our share of bullshit. The priest's tentacles shook with laughter.
You are correct, he said. Well, Chrysalis did tell me things in the sanctity of the confessional that I cannot reveal to you. But I can tell you that you are overlooking a source of information.
He paused dramatically.
Her neighbors, Daniel, Father Squid said. Her downstairs neighbors.
Brennan's expression was puzzled as Father Squid rose ponderously to his feet.
Now, if you'll excuse me, I have to prepare for the 10 o'clock mass.
10 a.m. Breakfast arrived as Jay was climbing out of the shower. He toweled himself dry, wondering what he was supposed to do about the damp bandages around his ribs, and slipped into the clothes Tachyon had loaned him. The sleeves were too short, and the pants showed off 2 inches of pale white ankle, but otherwise the suit fit well enough. The only problem was it was puce. Tachyon was seated in front of the room service tray, buttering a slice of toast, when Jay emerged from the bedroom. Blaze, stretched out across an armchair, looked up and sniggered. Tachyon gave his grandson a stern look. "Blaze, did you enjoy your ride on the luggage carousel?" The boy looked sullen.
"No, I felt stupid."
"Then by the ideal, you will mind your manners," Tachyon told him. "Or I will have Mr. Aykroyd teleport you back to the Atlanta airport."
"I can't help it if he's funny," Blaze complained. "He looks like a fruit."
"Those are my clothes," Tachyon pointed out stiffly. He looked at Jay. "Myself, I think it's a dramatic improvement." "I'm with the kid," Jay said. Blaze looked surprised. Then he grinned. Jay whipped up his finger in a quick draw move. Got the boy in his sights. Blaze flinched.
"Gotcha,"
Jay said. He smiled. So did Blaze. Popping the kid halfway across Atlanta had done wonders for their rapport. "He's enough of a rapscallion without your encouraging him," Tachyon complained. "Ah, he's okay," Jay said, pulling a chair over to the room service cart. "For a occasion." He lifted the silver dome off his plate and attacked the Eggs Benedict wolfishly. They weren't as good as the Eggs Benedict at Aces High, but he was hungry enough not to give a damn. Hiram always said Jay had a Naugahyde palate anyway. Tachyon was fastidiously patting his lips with a napkin, and Jay was mopping up the last of the yolk with a piece of toast when the knock came at the door. Tachyon stood.
"Who is there?"
"Carnifex, open up. I don't have all day." Tachyon glanced back at Jay.
"Let him in," Jay said. "Ray's tough.
But there's nothing he can do against you, me, and the Cisco kid over there." He gestured toward Blaze. The alien nodded and opened the door. Carnifex glanced around and stepped into the suite. Wearing his skin-tight white uniform that outlined every muscle and tendon in his body, the hood was thrown back to reveal a face that looked like it had been patched together out of spare parts. "Rig say we're supposed to stay out of the political bullshit," Ray told Tachyon with disdain. "Good for you. Otherwise I'd have to whip your ass. You've been hanging around Brawn too much, I guess. Some of it must have rubbed off." Tachyon's mouth tightened.
"Say what you came to say, Ray," he told the government ace. "Your opinions on political and moral issues interest me not in the slightest."
"Greg wants to see you," Billy Ray said.
"The sentiment is not reciprocated," Tachyon said.
"You'll see him," Ray said, with a crooked smile. "Greg said to tell you he has a proposition he wants to discuss."
"I have nothing to discuss with the senator."
"Scared?" Ray wanted to know.
"Don't worry. I'll hold your hand if you want," he shrugged.
"Come or don't come, either way, it's no skin off my nose. But if you don't, you're going to regret it." The ace in the white suit looked around the suite. At the windows Turtle had shattered, the television Hiram had dropped, the urine stain on the sofa.
"Must have been a hell of a party," he said to Tachyon.
"Somebody ought to teach you to clean up after yourself, Doc. This place is a mess." He was going out the door when Jay called out, "Hey, Carney!" Ray turned around with a dangerous glint in his green eyes.
"That's Carnifex, asshole."
"Carnifex, asshole," Jay repeated. "I'll try and remember. How many of those good humor suits you own?"
6 or 8, Carnifex said suspiciously. "Why?"
"Must be hell to get the bloodstains out," Jay said. Ray just stared at him.
"Stay out of my way, Seamus," he said, "or you'll find out firsthand."
He slammed the door behind him.
"Seamus," Jay said,
He actually called me Seamus. God, I'm so mortified. He turned to Tachyon. You gonna go?
The little man straightened. I must. Jay sighed. I was afraid you were gonna say something like that.
Brennan dropped Jennifer off half a block from the Crystal Palace, and then cruised on by. Given the mysterious note warning them about the palace, this seemed the safest way to check out the existence of the neighbors that Father Squid had told him about. Jennifer would scout in her insubstantial form, then come and get Brennan if the coast was clear. Brennan drove past the palace and into the alley upon which the service entrance fronted. He killed the engine and flicked on the radio while waiting for Jennifer to return. The news from Atlanta was more cheering than it had been the night before. Apparently, the initial reports of Jack Braun's demise had been greatly exaggerated. He was still alive. Golden Boy's ace had saved him again. Brennan's train of thought was interrupted by a suddenly blaring bullhorn that froze him behind the wheel.
You're in the car. This is the police. Come out with your hands up. We've got you covered. Come out with your hands up.
Brennan sat behind the wheel for an instant longer, his mind racing through, then discarding half a dozen escape plans. He watched through the windshield as three policemen approached. The two in uniform had pistols pointed right at him. The third, following a pace behind, was Mazurek. He put his hands up and then with slow, exaggerated movements, opened the door and got out of the car. He stood waiting for them, with no expression at all on his face.
Couldn't keep out of it, could you?
Mazurek asked. Hells can't, Brennan replied. A shadow of something crossed Mazurek's face.
Still a little shaky, but better.
One of the uniforms had opened the back door of the car, while the other kept a bead on Brennan.
It's him!
The first said excitedly.
The bow and arrow killer!
He brandished Brennan's bow case. You had the palace staked out, waiting for a killer to return, Brennan said. Mazurek shrugged.
Seemed like an idea.
Brennan shook his head in disgust. That was what the note meant. God damn.
All right,
the first patrolman said.
Put your hands on the fender. Feet back and spread your legs.
Brennan put his hands down, turned to comply. He didn't move fast enough, so the cop kicked his feet further apart and patted him down, finding the knife Brennan carried in an ankle sheath.
All right, turn around.
The cop was smiling as Brennan did.
We caught him. By Jesus, we caught the big bad vigilante. Put your hands behind your back, big guy.
Shut up, Chris, Mazurek said wearily as Brennan complied. He continued to speak in the same weary monotone as the patrolman cuffed Brennan.
You have the right to remain silent.
Brennan said nothing, nor offered any resistance. His face was hard as stone as they led him away to a patrol car parked out of sight past a turn in the alley.
Tachyon was practically shaking when he flung open the bedroom door. His bright hair plastered to his forehead by a cold sweat. He looked like he was about to recycle his breakfast. Even Blaze, who'd been talking and joking with Jay, had the sense to shut up when he saw the look in his grandfather's eyes. Mr. Ackroyd, come in here, please, Tack said. I need to talk to you. Jay got to his feet with a shrug. His pants rode up past his ankles. He tried to yank them down as he trailed Tachyon into the sitting room. What did Hartman want? He poked around the room service tray as he spoke, looking for something edible. Mr. Ackroyd, I require a favor of you.
Sure, Jay said. Name it.
Tachyon put a hand up. Do not be so quick to commit yourself. Having me in your debt may not be enough to outweigh what I will ask of you. Jay found an orange slice.
Jesus Christ, get to the point, Tachyon. All this flowery Tachyon bullshit.
He bit into the orange and sucked at the juice. Hartman is blackmailing me. I have refused to meet his demands. But I require time. A day, two at the most. And it will be over. Hartman will have lost the nomination. Tachyon paused for a long moment, his face morose, as if the whole notion made him weary beyond words. You can give me that time, he concluded finally.
The point, Jay prodded. The point.
You must remove a man from Atlanta. The more conventional means are closed to us. This all got weirder every day, Jay thought. Why, he asked. Who is this guy? Tachyon turned away from him. There was a snifter on the side table, half full of brandy. He groped for it like a drowning man groping for a lifesaver, and drained it in a gulp. Long ago, he said slowly, his back still turned, I was saved from death by a man who has alternately been a devil and an angel to me. Devils and angels, just what he needed, as if assassins and aces weren't enough. Shit, Jay said, throwing up his hands. This is difficult for me, Tack whined. He stared down at the empty snifter, rolling it between his palms. Then it all came out in a rush. In 1957, I was recruited by the KGB. It wasn't all that difficult. I would have done anything for a drink, at any rate. Years passed. I proved to be less useful than originally hoped. They cut me loose, and I thought I was free. Then last year, the man who ran me, those many long years ago, re-entered my life and called in the debt. He's here, in Atlanta. Jay gaped at him. The notion of the prissy little alien prince working for the Soviets was the craziest thing he'd ever heard. He would have been less surprised if Tachyon had confessed that he was really an elf. Why? Was all he could manage. Hartman, Tack replied. He suspected the existence of the monster. Now Hartman has found out about him, and our connection. Connection, Jay said. He is Blaze's tutor. Oh, hell. Jay sat down. He didn't know whether he should laugh or cry. Laugh, probably. They could always count on Tack to take care of the weeping. This is the bludgeon with which Hartman seeks to cow me, Tachyon declared. I am probably going to jail, Mr. Aykroyd, but I'll see him stopped before I go. You want me to pop this guy away? Yes, already. The FBI and the Secret Service have been alerted. They are combing Atlanta for George. Are you still a commie? Jay asked, straight-faced. Dr. Tachyon clutched at the little doily he wore at his throat, and drew himself up to his full height. I? Consider, Mr. Aykroyd. Yeah, Jay said. I get your drift. He stood up. Well, hey, it's all ancient history to me. Let's go pop this commie somewhere. Tachyon gave him a grave little nod and went to the bedroom. Blaze, he called. You're taking him? Jay was surprised. I mean, he knows? Of course. Come, child, he said to Blaze. The teenager shot him a venomous glance, but Tachyon missed it. I want you to have a chance to say farewell to George.
11 a.m. Captain Angela Ellis stamped out a cigarette in the overflowing ashtray and immediately lit another. She strode up and down before the chair in which Brennan sat, her frustration evident in her staccato pacing.
How long do you think you can remain silent? She asked Brennan.
Brennan looked directly at her for the first time in 20 minutes. Forever, he said softly.
Christ, why were you sitting in a car before the Crystal Palace at 10:05 this morning? What had been your relationship with Chrysalis? Did you kill her?
Brennan turned away, his face utterly blank, apparently totally devoid of feeling and emotion. Mazarek, sitting in the rear of the room, cleared his voice.
Begging your pardon, Captain, but I don't think he'll say anything.
Ellis whirled on him.
Somebody's got to say something. Some idiot let it leak that we've collared Yeoman, the bow and arrow killer. And there's got to be 100 reporters yammering at the sergeant on the front desk, and about half a dozen federal agencies are sending agents over to look into the affair, as they put it.
As far as I know, Brennan said softly, there's nothing illegal in sitting in a car. There's nothing illegal in carrying a bow and arrow.
Are you saying you're innocent? Are you saying you're not this yeoman?
Brennan said nothing, as Ellis whirled on him.
You have no identification, and your description matches that of a man wanted for desertion from the United States Army.
Superficially, Brennan said.
Close enough,
Ellis ground out.
So that we can hold you until the feds arrive with this deserter's dossier, which includes his fingerprints.
As you will, Brennan said, returning his gaze to infinity. Ellis ground out her cigarette, then crumpled the empty pack.
All right,
she said. She opened the door to the interrogation room and called in the patrolman who'd been standing outside.
Put him in the lockup. Maybe a few hours in a cell will loosen his tongue.
The cop nodded.
All right, tough guy, move it.
I'm not so sure that's a good idea, Mazzeri began, but Ellis nailed him with a stare, and he fell silent.
The cop led Brennan through a warren of interrogation rooms and offices, then downstairs to the general lockup. There were more than a dozen hard cases in there, waiting for bail to be arranged or other legal papers to be processed. They were a surly, tough-looking group. The jailer grinned as he opened the door and gestured for Brennan to enter.
Got someone famous for you guys to meet. His name's been in all the papers, he said. You've heard of Yeoman, the bow and arrow vigilante? Well, here he is.
He chuckled again, slammed the door, and sauntered back up the corridor. Brennan felt their hard stares and waited for the inevitable. It didn't take very long.
Shoot, someone said from the back of the cell. He don't look too tough to me.
He looks like a pussy,
someone else said.
Take away his bow and arrow, and he's just a pussy.
There was some low, cautious laughter. The man who spoke first pushed his way to the front of the cell, where Brennan stood with his back against the bars. He was a big, tough-looking gnat, with tattoos crawling up and down his arms, and a nose that had been broken more than once. The second speaker was shorter than Brennan, but powerfully built. His head was bald, and his face was a network of scars. They approached Brennan side by side as the others in the cell backed away.
He's a pussy, the first said. Here, pussy, pussy, pussy. We got something for you.
Brennan watched without expression. When they came within reach, he pivoted sideways and lashed out with his right foot, catching the short one in the groin. The man went down with a gurgle and then threw up all over himself. Brennan grabbed the other by the arm and whirled him face first against the cell's barred door. The door shook when the thug rammed up against it. His left arm went through the bars. Brennan reached out and grabbed his hand, then yanked his arm back into the cell, wrapping it between two bars. He howled as his arm snapped. Brennan grabbed a handful of greasy hair and shoved his head forward as hard as he could. It pushed through the bars, but not without leaving a lot of skin and one ear behind. His howling grew louder, and Brennan turned to face the rest of the cell.
Anyone else? He asked quietly.
There were mumbled denials, then a high, feminine voice said,
How about me?
The mob of thugs parted like the Red Sea, and there were awed, unbelieving whispers as Jennifer walked naked through the rear wall of the cell. She ran to Brennan and threw her arms around him.
Take a deep breath, she said,
and they sank through the floor of the cell. It was like nothing Brennan had ever felt before, almost like what dying might be like. They went through the floor and landed, light as feathers, on the floor of the room below the cell. Brennan ducked out of Jennifer's arms and glanced around quickly. It was dark and quiet. They seemed to be in some kind of file storage area.
Let's see if we can find you some clothes somewhere, he said to Jennifer,
but she didn't answer. She looked dazed and drawn and only turned to look at him when he touched her arm. He suddenly realized what a strain it must have been ghosting him. His mass was well over anything Jennifer had ever attempted to dematerialize before. Are you all right? He asked. Jennifer nodded, but even that seemed to be too much of an effort for her. She collapsed limply on the dusty floor. He bent over her. She was breathing long, shallow breaths. Her pulse was weak and thready. She obviously needed medical attention, but Tachyon, the only doctor Brennan trusted, was in Atlanta. At any rate, he had no time to agonize over it. They had to move. They needed a place to hide and recover. They needed a sanctuary.
They were being followed. Jay looked away from the taxi's side-view mirror. Somebody's on us, he said. What? Tachyon turned all the way around and gaped out the back rear window. staring suspiciously at the Volvo immediately behind. Jay touched his arm. Easy. He's good. You'll never spot him that way. Cabby? The detective fished out his wallet. There's an extra 50 for you if you can lose that gray Dodge. Back about 3 cars.
Sure thing, mister,
the cabby said, grinning. Jay rummaged through his billfold. Found a 10 and 3 ones. Cursed under his breath. A bribe here, a bribe there. Pretty soon, they add up to real money. He showed the bills to Tachyon. The alien grumbled and came up with the cash, leaning forward to tuck the money into the driver's shirt pocket. The cabbie hit the gas, and the taxi turned left, squealing. Tachyon landed in Jay's lap. In the front seat, Blaze grinned hugely.
Just like Bereskidge, Dad.
Huh? Jay's mind was on the car behind them. Never mind, said Tack. You know enough of my secrets. Jay glanced behind. Still on us. Damn, he's good. Tack was flitting about, as nervous as a bird.
What are we going to do?
There's probably not going to be time for any long goodbyes. The Motel 6 sign loomed ahead. Set us there, too, said Tachyon. It took Jay a moment to place the name. Sarah Morgenstern, the reporter who accused Hartman of being a monster. The one Mackie Messer had tried unsuccessfully to snuff. Jesus Christ, you got the whole New York Philharmonic there? Maybe the Dodgers? This is no laughing matter.
No shit!
Punch it, buddy. Everything she's got. The cab gunned down the street, veered into the motel lot on 2 wheels. They were out before it stopped. Jay threw his last 10 at the driver and ran, his broken ribs screaming with every step as he dashed across the asphalt. The door was opened by a dark, round-faced man in his 60s. Behind him on the bed, a pale blonde woman clutched a pillow as she watched the tube. The Russian backed up quickly as the 3 of them rushed inside. Jay slammed the door and locked it. Tachyon went straight for the blonde and yanked her to her feet. Blaze hugged the Russian.
No time to explain, Tachyon said breathlessly. Hartman knows. There is someone after us.
He grabbed the front of the girl's dress and ripped it off her with a single sharp yank. Sarah gave a shriek and tried to cover herself with her hands, looking at the alien like he'd gone nuts.
Into the shower, Tack said, pushing her toward the John.
She was wearing nothing but a little lacy bit of bra. Her pubic hair was the same pale blonde, Jay noted with interest.
Don't come out, and by the way, you rent by the hour.
Tack got the bra off on the run. Jay had to admire his manual dexterity. Footsteps came pounding down the hall outside. The Russian took it calmly.
There is no time, he said, holding Blaze.
Yes, there is, said Tack. Jay will get you out of Atlanta. For the God's sake, Blaze, move! The Russian disentangled himself from the boy.
Open up! Open the goddamn door!
Jay knew the voice. Carnifex.
Now,
Tachyon urged. Jay shrugged, pointed at the Russian. There was a pop. All of a sudden, they were short of Slav. Tack grabbed some vodka off a dresser, clutched it to his chest, and dove onto the bed. The door shattered with a crack. Billy Ray stepped through the splinters, brushing aside a jagged shard of wood with the back of his head. He had a gun, a big gun. One of those Dirty Harry jobs. The white gloves he wore as part of his fighting togs made it look even bigger and blacker. He pointed it at Tachyon, which was fine with Jay. He hated guns, especially when they were pointed at him.
All right, where is he? Ray wanted to know. Where the fuck is he?
Huh? Asked Jay.
Asshole.
Carnifex shoved at him contemptuously with the flat of his hand. Jay sat down hard. Carnifex looked around, spotted the closet, and acted like he'd made a discovery. He ripped the door off its hinges, grabbed handfuls of clothes, flung them to the floor. There was no Russian in the closet, Ray grimaced, dropped to his knees, peered under the bed. There was no Russian under the bed. He got up, swung toward the bathroom. Get out of there, now!
Well, sugar, how many of you boys there gonna be?
Sarah called out from under the shower. In the worst southern accent Jay Aykroyd had ever heard. Frowning, Carnifex stepped into the bathroom. They heard him yank back the shower curtain. They heard Sarah scream. They heard a slap. Ray came out of the bathroom with a red cheek and a wet costume, looking dour. He was here. The goddamn Russian was here.
Russian?
Jay looked at Tachyon, shrugged. I don't see any Russian. Do you see a Russian? And Sweet Cheeks in there. Sure don't sound Russian. Russian cost you extra. Why did you try to get away from me? Tachyon took a long drink.
Because I was afraid you were the press, and I didn't want to be found visiting a prostitute.
You always take a kid? He gestured at Blaze with the .44.
Could you put the gun away? It makes me nervous when you wave it around like that. Most fatal shootings are accidental, you know.
This wouldn't be an accident. Answer the fucking question. Tachyon cleared his throat.
Well, that is the matter in a nutshell. It's time the boy learned.
He glanced about the motel room. This lacks the ambience that I could wish. But she is very good. I tried her myself last night. Of course, nothing can compare with the woman my father gave me on my 14th birthday.
Disgusted, Carnifex bolted out for the broken door. Jay looked at Tachyon with no respect.
14? He said. No kidding? Oh, Aykroyd, please.
1 p.m. Brennan carried Jennifer, wrapped up in his denim jacket, down into the sewer line. She seemed to be getting worse. Her skin was feeling cool and feverish in turn, and she was murmuring gibberish that Brennan couldn't make heads or tails of. He moved as quickly as he could through the semi-darkness of the sewer. He had to stop every now and then and put Jennifer down in order to climb to the surface to check his route. But Brennan had a good sense of direction below as well as above ground. It led him with only a few false turns to his destination, Our Lady of Perpetual Misery. He carried Jennifer back up to the surface and over to the small rectory attached to the rear of the church. He kicked the door several times with his foot. Father Squid opened the door after a moment, his look of annoyance quickly turning to one of surprise and concern.
"Merciful Lord," he said, "what happened?"
"I'll tell you in a moment, Father," Brennan said, pushing past the priest. "Right now, we have to get a doctor. One you can trust to keep his mouth shut. Know anybody that fits that description?"
"Well, there's Mr. Bones."
"Get him."
"He's not a real doctor. Is he good?"
Father Squid nodded.
"The people around here swear by him. Sometimes I think he knows more about Joker physiology than Tachyon."
Brennan nodded. "All right, get him." Father Squib bustled off to his bedroom to make the call, while Brennan set Jennifer down gently on the priest's beat-up old sofa and then flexed his tired arms. He knelt down by her and felt her forehead. It was cold again, although sweat was beading up and running down her forehead and high cheekbones. As he held her hand, it began to turn ghostly in his, as she phased in and out of her material state, uncontrollably and unconsciously. "Jennifer." He tried to wake her up, but she didn't seem to hear him. He was afraid to shake her, afraid to move her at all. Her skin was white as death, her breath infrequent and shallow. Father Squid came back into his neat little living room, bringing a blanket that he gently draped over Jennifer.
"He was in. He'll be here soon. Now, tell me, my son, what's going on here?"
"I guess I owe you that," Brennan said. He settled down tiredly on the floor next to Jennifer, refused the priest's offer of coffee, and told him what had happened that day. While he spoke, half of his mind was condemning the obsession that had put him and Jennifer in this desperate situation, and half was wondering about the palace and Chrysalis's downstairs neighbors and how he could get by the police surrounding the place. When he finished the tale, there was a slow, measured knocking on the rectory door. Father Squid went to answer it and let in a tall black man who looked like a resurrectionist out of a Boris Karloff movie. Mr. Bones was old, thin and gaunt. He wore a white shirt and an old black suit that was clean and neatly repaired, but much too short for his long, lanky limbs. This joker wasn't severe as things went. In fact, the two feathery antennae growing out of his forehead were rather attractive. They twitched like ferns blowing in a gentle breeze as Father Squid introduced him to Brennan.
"This the patient?"
Bones asked as he knelt down before Jennifer. He stripped the blanket off her. As he took her pulse, he bent very close to her and moved his head up and down her body. His antennae twitched and rotated like sensitive radar receptors. "How is she, doctor?" Brennan asked quietly.
"I'm not a doctor,"
Bones replied, still running his antennae over Jennifer. After a moment, he rocked back on his heels and looked at Brennan and Father Squid.
"Her system's had quite a shock. Right now, all we can do for her is let her rest."
He covered over the blanket and stood up.
"And hope for the best."
4 p.m. "So, Neffy," Jay said, leaning against the hood of Jesse Jackson's limo. Tachyon was inside the Hyatt Regency, conferring with his new candidate, and Ackroyd was getting tired of waiting. "The feds pay good or what?" Jesse Jackson's ace bodyguard looked at him like he was some kind of canker sore. He was a tall, thin Mormon with a receding hairline, a gaunt, chiseled face, and the best damn posture Jay had ever seen. The press called him Straight Arrow. The nameplate over his breast pocket said, "Neffy Callender." "Some of us are not interested in personal gain," he told Jay. "Some of us are just grateful for a chance to serve God and our country." Jay smiled. "Yeah, sure. And some of you just like to beat people up, right?" Straight Arrow frowned and looked away. "Heard that Carnifex got in some kind of brawl Sunday night," Jay said casually. "Or maybe it was Monday morning. Really pounded the shit out of some guy." "Is that a fact?" Callender did not seem terribly interested. "I wouldn't know. I'm sure no more force was applied than was appropriate to the situation. Ray is an experienced agent with an outstanding record." "A hell of a dresser, too," Jay said. "Me, I don't think I could wear all that white. It's a bitch to keep clean. I like your outfit a lot better." The Mormon ace wore a tailored gray dress uniform. It looked very crisp and proper and military, until you picked up the Justice Department insignia on the sleeves and the dark red braid on cap and shoulder boards. His collar was fastened with a jewel pin fashioned in the shape of a flaming arrow. "Free laundry service come with the job, or you guys have to pay the dry cleaning yourself?" Jay wanted to know. Straight Arrow took a long pointed look at Jay's puce suit. "I'd recommend burning, not cleaning," he said. "Funny man," Jay said. "These are tackies. I think he wants them back. Don't ask me why." "Why all the interest in laundry, Ackroyd?" "When my face got rearranged, I bled all over my lucky shirt. The bruises were a delightful greenish-yellow shade today. You know how it is when you got a lucky shirt. I figured you feds might know a place where I could get it cleaned. I hear that Carnifex had blood all over him after his little fracas on Sunday night." "You shouldn't believe everything you hear, Ackroyd," Callender told him. "As far as I know, Ray was with Senator Hartman Sunday night, as per his assignment. If a situation arose requiring him to use force, regulations would have required that he file a report. No such report is on file." Before Jay could reply, Tachyon emerged through the front door of the Hyatt, Jesse Jackson at his side. The sidewalk was crowded with Jackson supporters waving bright red Jesse signs. Straight Arrow's eyes moved restlessly, scanning the faces, as the two men clasped hands and lifted them over their heads. The black man was so much taller that Tachyon had to stand on his toes. A ragged cheer went up. Then Jackson and Tachyon headed for the limo, smiling and shaking hands as the spectators crowded in around them. Jackson pressed the flesh with practiced ease, but Tachyon looked distinctly uncomfortable. "What now?" Jay asked Tachyon when he reached the limo.
Jesse wants us to talk to the Jokers outside the Omni, Tachyon explained. He was wilting in the Atlanta heat. He and I together, his positions on wildcard issues are just as strong as Hartman's, if they will only listen. He gave a long, deep sigh. Jay, if you have other leads to follow up, there's really no need for you to come along. Jay thought about it for a moment. As far as he knew, he didn't have a single lead that was worth a damn. He shrugged. Might as well, he said. Can't dance. Inside the limo, the air conditioning was cranked up and cooking. But Tachyon wilted visibly once out of the public eye. Even Jay could see how much he dreaded facing the Jokers who had gathered in front of the convention center, many of whom considered him a traitor for deserting Hartman in his hour of need. They hate me now, he said with despair, glancing through the tinted windows at the crowds. Only some, Jackson said as the limo came to a stop. It's not as if you switched your support to Barnett. I'm not that unacceptable, am I? Not to me. Tachyon squeezed Jesse's arm. Jay wasn't sure who was reassuring whom, and you will convince them. I know it. Well, help me a little. I will do my uttermost best, Tachyon declared. The limo doors were thrown open, and they climbed out one by one. Secret Service men in dark suits and sunglasses were watching the crowd suspiciously, and a squad of uniformed cops had cordoned off a narrow path from the limo to the flatbed truck, hung with red Jackson banners, where the microphones were waiting. Jokers pressed closely around them, on all sides. Some stared in dead silence. Others grinned and yelled out their support. Still others screamed obscenities. Everyone was cooking in the heat. How can they hate them so? Tachyon asked plaintively of no one in particular. They are pitiful and so brave. So very brave. The cops struggled to hold back that sea of twisted humanity as the Jokers surged forward. Slowly, the party began to make its way down to the truck. Hands were thrust at them from all sides. Between the linked arms of the policemen, over their shoulders, around their backs, Jesse moved along one side of the line, grabbing each hand in turn, giving it a quick squeeze, then moving on to the next. Tachyon, less enthusiastic, worked the other side. An elderly man with gills spat in his face. Others tried to kiss his ring. Jay kept his hands shoved deep in his pockets, several paces behind. Straight Arrow walked beside him, keeping a careful eye on Jackson. The ace's broad forehead was dotted with sweat. Overhead, the turtle slid across the sky. Sometime during the night, someone had painted Hartman across his shell in silver letters 3 feet high. A vast pale wall of moon-faced flesh suddenly loomed up behind two policemen, broke through the cordon, and waddled toward Tachyon. Secret Service men reached for their pistols. No, it's okay, Jay said. That Stowboy. He's simple-minded, but he won't hurt him. Straight Arrow weighed Jay's words, gave a curt nod. The Secret Service relaxed. Doughboy and Tachyon exchanged a few quiet words. The alien looked like he was going to break down and cry. I hate this, Straight Arrow muttered. Somewhere in the crowd, a chant of, Traitor! Went up. Tachyon stopped and hid his face in his hands. Jesse had to put an arm around his shoulders and whisper encouragement in his ear to get the Takesian going again. Even then, Tack smiled, looked like it had been pasted on. The alien grasped the flipper of a legless Joker who had thrust it up between a policeman's legs. He said a few words, smiled, moved on. More hands reached for him. A thin teenager in worn leathers slid through the crowd, smiling. Just three people down the line. How the hell could anyone wear leather in this heat? Jay wondered briefly. He was glancing away when something, the hunger in that lean face, the bright glitter in the boy's eyes, caught his attention and held it. Tachyon touched, oh so lightly, the twisted fingers of a foul-smelling joker whose huge boils oozed with pus. He looked a little green, but he forced a smile. One of the boy's shoulders was higher than the other.
No!
Jay screamed, moving forward, hands sliding out of his pockets. The boy grasped Tachyon's hand.
I'm Mackie Messa,
Jay heard him say, as the buzzsaw kicked in.
I was in medical school in 1946, Mr. Bones said between sips of tea, when the wild card came down out of the sky. My deformity was slight, but enough to get me banished from school. It was unusual enough to be a black man in medical school, but a joker black man couldn't be tolerated.
You use your antennae in your work, don't you? Brennan asked.
Bones nodded. After a while, I discovered that they've given me a sixth sense, somewhere between taste and smell and touch, that's probably about as hard to describe as sight to a blind man. Through the years, I've learned to use it to help detect wrongness in my patients.
He put down his cup and turned to Jennifer as she moaned loudly, the first sound she'd made in hours. He ran his antennae over her body, listened to her heartbeat, and said to Brennan,
Give me my bag.
Brennan brought it over and put it beside him. He reached in for a hypodermic and a bottle of clear fluid and gave her an injection. Her breathing was fluttery and rapid. Her forehead was beaded with sweat. She sat straight up and cried out,
Daniel, where are you, Daniel?
It seemed she couldn't see him, even though he was standing right next to her. Bones moved over and gestured for Brennan to take his place. He knelt down and held Jennifer. She clung to him fiercely, and her skin was cold, even though she was soaked with sweat.
Daniel,
she murmured, and suddenly went limp. Brennan looked at Bones desperately, who reassuringly put a large knuckled hand on his shoulder.
It's all right, son. Let her down gently. I think she's past the crisis point.
Brennan held her at arm's length and looked at her. She seemed to be sleeping deeply. Her breath was firm and measured. He let her down against the pillow, and she sighed and turned over.
She needs sleep, Bones said. I'm going to give her a sedative, and I don't want her to be disturbed for at least 24 hours.
A vast sense of relief swept through Brennan. She'll be all right? He asked. Bones nodded. Thanks, Doctor. Mr. Bones. What do I owe you?
Bones shrugged lean shoulders. I don't have set fees. My patients pay what they can.
Brennan reached for his denim jacket, which was slung over a chair next to the sofa. He took a flat roll of money from a secret pocket sewn into the inside and gave it all to Bones. This is all I have with me, he said. If there's anything else you ever need, call this number, and I'll do what I can. Brennan scribbled the number down on a piece of paper he took from Father Squid's secretary and handed it to him. Bones riffled through the money Brennan had given him.
You're very generous, he said.
Brennan shook his head as he watched Jennifer sleep peacefully on the sofa. You've done more for me than I could ever repay. I'll always be in your debt.
Under the high, thin shriek of Tack's screaming was the hideous wet sound of a power saw cutting meat. Fingers and pieces of flesh and bone were flying everywhere. The boy stood there, fine drops of Tachyon's blood spattering his face and arm and leathers, with a sound like summer rain. All the time smiling. His mouth opened just a little, tongue moving slightly across his lower lip. It seemed to Jay like he was moving in slow motion. His hand came up, fingers sliding into the shape of a gun. Tachyon staggered back, blood jetting from the ragged ruin of his right hand. The boy's hands were a blur. A cop grabbed him by the jacket. The leather boy sliced off his arm, clean at the shoulder, like it was the easiest thing in the world, and turned back to Tachyon. The alien had stumbled to his knees. The boy reached down for him, almost gently, as if he were going to caress his cheek, stroke that long red hair. But Jay was pointing. No one heard the pop. Too many people were screaming, but suddenly, Mackie Messer was gone. Dazed, trembling,
Jay was hardly aware of the big blonde man who came crashing out of the crowd an instant later. Glowing as yellow as a bug light and staggering almost in a circle, as he punched at an assassin who was no longer there.
"Who did that?"
he shouted. All around them, people were shouting, running into each other. The Secret Service had knocked down Jesse and covered him with their bodies.
"An ambulance!"
a distant voice was calling.
"Someone get an ambulance! Damn it! Damn it! Someone get an ambulance!"
Everybody was waving guns, and Straight Arrow was holding a flaming arrow up over his head. TV cameras were circling like sharks. Jay heard someone say, "Ackroyd," but he wasn't sure who. The policeman was still making a hideous noise, but Tachyon had fallen silent. When Jay reached him, the little alien lay on the pavement, still as death, his eyes closed, his right arm clutched to his chest. Blood still came in short, ragged spurts from his wrist, and the ruffles of his lace shirt were as red as his hair. Jay smelled something burning, somewhere behind him. Then he was shoved aside none too gently. Straight Arrow knelt over Tachyon. Dimly, from his own haze of confusion and shock, Jay watched. The man held his hands over the raw, wet stump. Pale yellow flames leapt from his fingertips, and the smell of burning flesh filled the air. Tachyon's body thrashed feebly. The stump was black and seared when Callender stood up. A couple of paramedics lifted Tachyon onto a stretcher. Jay wasn't sure when they'd arrived. "Ackroyd," someone said. Jay looked around. Straight Arrow was talking to him. "Where did you send him?" Jay couldn't think straight. "Yeah," he said. His hand was still clenched tightly in its gun shape. He flexed his fingers, ran them through his hair. "Oh, Jesus," he said, patting himself to make sure he was intact.
"You!"
someone bellowed at him. It was the big blonde guy. He looked almost as young as the leather boy.
"Who the hell are you?"
"Jay Ackroyd," Straight Arrow told him. "Private cop. They call him Poppin' Jay."
"I had the bastard!"
The blonde guy made a fist, crushing a pack of cigarettes that he didn't seem to realize he was holding. Little bits of tobacco dribbled down over his pants.
"I could have turned him into jello. Ah, fuck!"
He threw down the squashed cigarettes and kicked them into the crowd. Suddenly, Jay recognized Golden Boy. The reports of Braun's death were obviously exaggerated. Nobody ever told him anything.
"Where did you send him, Ackroyd?"
Straight Arrow asked.
"Popped him."
His lips were very dry. When he licked them, Jay tasted blood. The Mormon ace grabbed his lapels and shook him.
"Where did you send the assassin?"
"Oh," Jay said.
"New York. The Tombs."
Straight Arrow let him go.
"Good."
But Golden Boy was a lot less pleased.
"He walks through walls!"
he yelled. He seemed to feel a need to scream everything. Jay was starting to understand why Braun had never made it as an actor.
"He's out by now!"
That made Straight Arrow very unhappy. The Mormon gave a long sigh, then turned and walked away. Jay followed him, leaving Braun alone with his histrionics.
"Tachyon,"
Jay asked, grabbing Callender by the arm.
"Is he going to live?"
"Only God can answer that question, Ackroyd. Pray."
6 p.m. Brennan sat in Father Squid's rectory, waiting for the dark. The priest was out on an errand for Brennan. Jennifer was still sleeping peacefully on the couch. Brennan had turned on the father's small black-and-white television, and with the volume turned way down, was watching with disbelief the day's events in Atlanta. The highlight, shown repeatedly from every conceivable angle and in excruciating slow motion, was Tachyon losing his hand. It was shown again and again until Brennan thought he was going to be sick. The latest word accompanying the footage was that Tachyon had lost a lot of blood and that he'd had such a severe shock to his system that the wound might prove fatal. Brennan prayed that the little alien would pull through. They were friends and comrades, having fought both the Swarm and the Shadow Fist together. But also Brennan felt that Tachyon was one of the few people in the world who understood his motivations. Tachyon knew why he'd been compelled to fight Kian and the Shadow Fists. He had a sense of personal duty as deep as Brennan's. As he watched the clip of Tachyon losing his hand for the nth time, Brennan suddenly recognized someone else in the scene. Popinjay was at Tachyon's side. What the hell was the PI doing in Atlanta? Had he abandoned Chrysalis's case, or had some clue taken him to the convention? As Brennan was wondering about all this, Father Squid returned, carrying a gym bag and a large flat-sided leather case. He put the bags down before Brennan and said seriously,
"I don't know if I should be encouraging you in this, Daniel."
"You're not encouraging me, Father. You know that I'm doing only what must be done." He unzipped the leather case and took out his backup bow. The police had his other bow and most of his arrows, but Brennan had some left. Enough, he hoped. He opened up his gym bag and took out a black jumpsuit. He draped it over a chair and continued to wait for the dark.
8 p.m.
"I wish George was here," Blaze said.
For a moment, Jay thought the boy was talking about George Bush. The hospital waiting room had two television sets, both tuned to the convention, and he'd been hearing a lot about George Bush from the commentators. He was about to tell the kid that the last thing any of them needed right now was a Republican when it dawned on him that Blaze meant his jolly old KGB uncle. "George is in New York," Jay told him. Mackie Messer was in New York, too. But he wasn't in the tombs. Jay had phoned. Mackie had freaked out, turned a couple of his cellmates into Alpo, and walked right through the bars. The carnage in front of the Omni kept playing and replaying in his head, like a bad splatter movie. Jack Braun was one of the champion weenies of all time. But maybe he was right. Maybe Jay had fucked up, had inadvertently saved Mackie Messer by popping him away before Braun could get to him. Or maybe he'd saved Tachyon's life. He just wasn't sure. And whether Golden Boy could actually have gotten to Mackie or not, teleporting him into the tombs had been a ghastly mistake. There were other places Jay could have picked, empty, deserted places, where no one would have died. Mackie was psychotic. He knew that from Digger. He should have thought about what his reaction would be when he found himself in that cell. But there hadn't been time to think. Everything had happened so goddamn fast. A horsefly was buzzing around Jay's head. He brushed it away and sighed. This afternoon was over. There was nothing he could do about it now, except live with it for a long, long time. They were the last ones left in the waiting room. A few reporters still haunted the steps outside, but only family, friends, and VIPs had been admitted to the hospital itself. There had been quite a few during the first hour of their vigil. Jokers by the score had come and gone, some bearing flowers or books or other tokens of their esteem. Hiram Worcester sat with Jay for almost an hour during the dinner recess, pale and silent.
"I have to get back to the floor," he said when he finally stood to leave. "Tell him I was here."
Jay had promised that he would. Leo Barnett prayed for Tachyon and the TV cameras during his visit. "Lord," the Reverend had proclaimed, "hear me now and spare this sinner. Grant him his life, that he may come to wisdom at last and know your power and mercy, O Lord, and accept you into his heart as his personal savior." Conifex had swung by briefly, flashed his badge, and grilled one of the doctors. Jay was too far away to overhear what was said, but Ray seemed satisfied. A man in a cheap rubber frog mask had stuck it out longest, pacing restlessly as they waited for word, finally leaving as quietly as he had come. He was the last,
Now there was only Jay and Blaze.
You think Dizian is going to die? Blaze asked.
He didn't sound very upset about the possibility. His tone was more one of idle curiosity than of fear. Nah, Jay said. If he was going to die, he'd have done it already. We've been here, what, 3 hours? He wasn't sure who he was trying to reassure, the boy or himself.
If he dies, baby belongs to me,
Blaze mused. Baby? Jay said, confused. What baby?
That's his spaceship,
the boy said, with all of a child's contempt for an adult who didn't know something he assumed everyone ought to know.
It's a stupid name. I'm going to think up a better name for her when she's mine.
Tachyon's not dead yet, Jay said. Blaze yawned. He was stretched out across his chair in a boneless sprawl that said he could care less, his legs thrown up carelessly on the coffee table.
Was it really as gross as they say?
He asked. His eyes moved restlessly, tracking the flies that circled around his head.
The Secret Service guy, the one who drove me? He said there was blood and fingers and everything just flying through the air.
It was real ugly, Jay said. The conversation was making him distinctly uncomfortable.
I bet he cried, Blaze said contemptuously. He should have let me come. I could have grabbed the guy with my mind, just like that.
He shot his hand out suddenly and caught the fly in his fist. Jay could hear it buzzing between the boy's fingers.
I could have made him cut himself up.
Blaze closed his fist hard around the fly.
That would have been something,
he said casually, opening his fingers and staring at the remains of the insect with a strange little smile on his face. Jay had a sudden image of the little hunchback killer lopping off his fingers one by one and singing I'm a Little Teapot as blood fountained from the stumps. You know, Blaze, he said, you are one weird fucking kid. Maybe he was being uncharitable. The boy might be in shock, terrified at the thought of losing his only living relative, hiding fear beneath a pose of indifference and adolescent bravado. Only somehow, Jay didn't think so. The boy looked up at him. Beneath his tousled mass of glittery red hair, his eyes regarded Jay haughtily. They were purple, Jay saw. So dark that they were almost black. Under the bright fluorescent light of the hospital waiting room, they looked like pools of violet ink.
I am not a kid, Blaze informed Jay. Antakis, I'd be leaving the woman's quarters.
Figures, Jay said. Just when you get old enough to want in, they throw you out.
9 p.m. The tunnels were dark, deserted, and very quiet. Brennan had figured they would be. He knew that the police had staked out the Crystal Palace, but he'd hoped they didn't know about the secret underground entrance Chrysalis had built. And they didn't. At least so far, it seemed as if they didn't. Brennan had left Father Squid's rectory, with the priest still watching over a sleeping Jennifer, and had gone underground 2 blocks from the palace. He left the main line at Henry Street and went down the tunnel he'd used to gain access to the palace the night he'd surprised the oddity in Chrysalis's bedroom. There was, he remembered, a short spur off the tunnel that he'd never investigated before. He stopped before it, debating his course of action. The only light a dim beam from the flashlight he held in one hand. In the other was his bow, already assembled. As he stood there debating with himself, he heard a noise coming from the tunnel before him. It was a small, skittering noise, as of many tiny feet trying to be silent. He shone his light into the darkness with little effect. He didn't want to keep the flashlight illuminating himself as the perfect target in the otherwise dark tunnel, but he couldn't stand the thought of turning it off and standing there in utter blackness. He put it down at his feet and backed away, taking an arrow out of his quiver and placing it on his bowstring. As he stepped out of the feeble circle of light cast by his flashlight, he heard a voice. Her voice.
Daniel, my dear Archer, you don't have to be afraid of me.
It was Chrysalis's voice. Or her ghosts. There was no denying it.
The double doors to the waiting room opened with a bang. "Are you the family?" a tired voice asked. Jay got to his feet. "I'm a friend," he said. He jerked a thumb toward Blaze. "He's the grandson." "Grandson?" The doctor sounded momentarily nonplussed. "Oh, that's right," he finally said. "I keep forgetting. The patient is older than he looks, isn't that right?" "The question is not how old he is," Jay said. "The question is he going to get any older?" "He suffered massive blood loss, not to mention major systemic shock," the doctor told him. "And it appears he was in a terribly weakened condition to begin with. Fortunately, first aid was applied at the scene. That made all the difference. Any more blood loss, and he might have been DOA. We started him on plasma as soon as he arrived. The hand, I'm afraid we had to lose it. It wasn't a clean cut, you have to realize. The paramedics brought us two of the fingers. But with the way the flesh was, well, chewed up, there just wasn't a hand to reattach them to. Amputation seemed the only viable op." "Okay," Jay snapped impatiently. "So from now on, if he loses one mitten, it's no big deal. Is he going to live?" The doctor blinked at him, then nodded. "Yes," he said. "Yes, I believe we've pulled him through. We're listing his condition as serious but stable." "I want to see him," Blaze said, in his most imperious tone. "I'm afraid we don't allow visitors in the intensive care unit," the doctor said. "Perhaps tomorrow we can move."
"Take us to him now,"
Blaze said. Those dark purple-black eyes narrowed just a little. He grinned boyishly. The doctor spun on his heels, straight-armed the double doors, and led them back to the ICU without another word. A bag of plasma hung over one side of the bed, an IV bottle over the other. Tachyon had tubes in his arms, and more tubes up his nose, wires attached everywhere. His eyes were closed, but Jay could see his chest rise and fall beneath the thin cotton of his hospital gown. "He's heavily sedated," the doctor said softly. Blaze must have let him go. For the pain. Jay nodded and glanced over at Blaze. The boy was staring down at his grandfather with a look of ferocious intensity on his face. His eyes glistened, and for a moment, Jay thought he saw a tear there. Then he realized it was only the moving readout on the monitor, reflected in the iris of his eyes. "Come on, Blaze," he said. "There's nothing we can do here." They passed through the waiting room again on the way out of the hospital. Up on the television screen, the convention was going crazy. Jesse Jackson was standing at the podium. People were screaming, balloons were falling from the ceiling, signs were waving madly, and the band had struck up a rousing chorus of "Happy Days Are Here Again." Jay had a bad feeling. He stopped by the nurse's station. "What's happened?" he asked the nurse on call.
"Jesse just gave a speech. You should have heard him. It brought tears to my eyes. He's throwing his delegates to Hartman. It's all over but the voting."
"Over?" Jay wanted to tell her. "Lady, it's just beginning." But he chewed his lip and said nothing. Blaze stood in front of the television, looking almost happy. When Jay came back over, he looked up eagerly.
"They're going to nominate Hartman, just like George said they would."
The network cut away from the convention floor to the streets of Atlanta. Thousands of jokers were dancing in the streets. Outside the Omni, the "Hartman" cry went up louder and louder. An impromptu parade was starting on Peachtree, a conga line that grew as it moved. Piedmont Park was one huge explosion of joy. The network cut from park to convention floor to street, letting the moment speak for itself. Jay put his hand on Blaze's shoulder and was just about to say that it was time they got back to the hotel when the boy said,
"Hey, look, Sasha."
Jay looked. They were showing Piedmont Park, where a dozen jokers were dancing giddily around a bonfire while 50 others watched. He was standing just behind the dancers,
the flames of the fire shining off slick dark hair, pencil-thin mustache, and that pale eyeless face.
Son of a bitch, Jay said. He'd almost forgotten about Sasha.
He shouldn't have. The skinny fuck had some answers he needed. He was about to tell Blaze to head back to the Marriott on his own when he remembered what the kid could do with his mind control. All of a sudden, Jay had a better idea.
Hey, kid, he said. Want to play detective?
Brennan didn't believe in ghosts, but whatever was approaching from down the dark tunnel and speaking in Chrysalis's voice couldn't be Chrysalis. Chrysalis was dead. He'd seen her in her coffin. The face in the window had only been a dream. He backed away until he stood against the side of the tunnel and couldn't move anymore.
Daniel,
the voice said,
I want to help you.
And the speaker stepped into the light. Brennan lowered his bow, dumbfounded. He couldn't believe his eyes. It was Chrysalis, a miniature Chrysalis, perfect in every detail, but no more than 18 inches tall. Now he knew why the window had appeared so large in what he thought was his dream. He squatted down to see her better as she approached fearlessly. The mannequin mimicked her perfectly, down to the red-painted fingernails, down to the tiny perfect heart beating in the cage of her ribs, down to the off-the-shoulder wrap that left one minute breast bare, invisible but for a tiny dark nipple, smaller than an eraser on the tip of a pencil.
Who are you? Brennan asked.
Come with me, and I shall tell you everything.
She smiled at him, turned, and walked back down the dark tunnel. He watched her for a moment, then, knowing he wasn't going to learn anything by remaining in the darkness, followed her, stopping only to pick up his flashlight. The corridor was short, but it took several minutes to traverse because the miniature Chrysalis took very tiny steps. Brennan shuffled slowly behind her. He directed his light to the end of the tunnel, eventually discovering that it ended in what seemed to be a blank wall. When they reached it, the little Chrysalis called out, and a hidden panel slipped open. Suspicious red eyes peered out.
I have brought the archer, she said.
He could hurt us, the watchman said in a deep, surly voice.
She said to trust him when his word was given.
The little Chrysalis turned and looked at Brennan.
Do you promise not to hurt us?
Mystified and bewildered, Brennan said, I promise. There was a sound of creaky bolts being thrown and protesting metal squeaked on rusty runners. Dim light spilled from the hidden door as it swung slowly open.
Then enter, the watchman said.
Brennan and the little Chrysalis stood at the threshold of a corridor. There were 20 or so beings in it. None were over 18 inches tall, some were a lot smaller. Some were perfectly formed mannequins, other grotesque parodies of humanity, test models discarded by the creator and never put into mass production. Some looked more like animals than people, but all stared at Brennan with intelligence in their eyes.
She said to trust you. She said you would help,
the watchman said from the small platform that had been bolted next to the hidden door's peephole. He was one of the human-looking ones, though his leathery skin hung in folds over his nearly naked body like an overcoat that was 6 sizes too big.
Who are you?
Brennan asked in a small voice.
We were Chrysalis's eyes and ears, the Chrysalis mannequin said proudly. We moved about the city, unseen and undreamed of by the big world, and brought her the news that she was so eager to hear. She gave us a place to live, warm and dry and out of sight.
She wiped a tear that dropped down a crystalline cheek.
But now she's dead.
It's you, Brennan said in a soft voice, who's been leaving me notes and calling me up.
That's right,
the tiny Chrysalis said.
We only tried to help. We stopped when we realized that we were confusing and hurting you. We were only trying to help you find out who murdered our lady. We tried to help the detective, too, but he only called us names and chased us.
Then you don't know who killed her? Brennan asked. The mannequin shook her head.
We never spied on the lady. It was a rule. She liked her loneliness, even if at times she was sad in it.
Brennan nodded. But you know where she kept her files?
She would come and knock, and we would let her in. Then we would tell stories of what we'd seen, what we'd learned in our hidden places in the world outside. She would bring food and drink, and we would eat as she wrote things down. Once she never came for months. We wrote ourselves, but it was no fun without the lady.
Where? Brennan asked. Where did you write? The tiny joker pointed a tiny finger to the chamber at the end of the corridor. More of the tribe were in the hallway, watching Brennan with eyes that were frightened and distrustful, angry and sad. One of the jokers, who looked like a tiny monkey with too many legs, turned on a shaded lamp as Brennan approached. The more skittish of Chrysalis's tiny spies peered at them silently from the dark edges of the room. The chamber was simply furnished with a comfortable chair, an antique desk, and a Tiffany lamp. Notebooks and binders and stacks of paper cluttered the desk. As Brennan glanced through them, he saw snippets about the sex life of politicians and the drug habits of bankers, notes on alliances between cops and gang figures, and even a list of which Dodgers had trouble with high fastballs and which were suckers for curveballs in the dirt. Brennan frowned. Is this it? He asked the homunculus. How in the world does she keep track of everything? Didn't she have a computer?
She didn't need a computer,
the chrysalis mannequin told Brennan.
She had a mother.
Mother? The mannequin nodded and pointed. Brennan turned to follow her gesture and saw two homunculi dragging at a pull cord attached to a dark tapestry that covered the chamber's back wall. They pulled back the tapestry, and Brennan stared at what was revealed. There was a wall of flesh growing over a trestle against the back wall. It was gray and pink and purple and pulsated with a rippling rhythm, like a swimming manta ray. It was totally featureless. A dozen or so of the mannequins hung from or clung to the flesh. Some were clearly attached to the thing, growing from cords attached to their heads, limbs, or stomachs. Others were nestling against it, as if for security or comfort.
What is it?
Brennan asked in a whisper.
Mother,
the little chrysalis said,
we are her children. She cannot see, no talk aloud, but she speaks with her mind. She knows she remembers everything we whisper to it while we rest in her bosom. Our lady gave her, and us, refuge. In return, she remembered for the lady.
She can't talk? Brennan asked. The homuncula shook her head.
Only through her children.
Brennan, who thought he'd seen just about every kind of joker imaginable, shook his head. He wondered where Chrysalis had found it, her, actually, and how they had made their bargain. It was a story he would like to hear, but now there was no time. Later he and the little people could sit down and puzzle it out. Now he still had a murder to uncover. How can I talk to the mother? Brennan asked.
Through us, or, she said, you might find what you're looking for in the lady's journal.
Her journal? Somehow that sounded easier than dealing with Mother, and she was there for questioning if the journal didn't pan out. Where is it?
Right there,
the homuncula said, pointing at a leather-bound volume sitting on top of the cluttered desk. As Brennan reached for it, he heard a soft, scuttling step where there was no one to make it. He drew back barely in time as something invisible and metallic swung through the air, caught his cheek, and ripped it open, leaving a bloody gash. Between him and the diary, a pair of brown eyes floated 5.5 feet from the ground. There was a loud cheering, and many of the homunculi ran for the dark corners of the room as Fadeout materialized, pointing a pistol at Brennan.
Surprise, surprise, he said, grinning. Drop your damn bow.
10 p.m. The park was as hot and humid as a hooker's mouth. Fires burned everywhere, and shouts and snatches of song echoed through the trees as they wandered from tent to tent, from campfire to campfire, looking for Sasha. In this hour, this night of triumph, even supposed gnats like he and Blaze were welcome. Everywhere they went, jokers shook their hands and slapped them on the back. Drinks were being thrust at them every time they turned around. Hartman buttons were pinned on their clothing at each stop. The night was heady with aroma, sausages sizzling on a hibachi, hobo stew simmering over a campfire, a pair of squirrels turning slowly on a spit. The sound of beer cans being popped surrounded them like 1,000 aluminum crickets. People were drunk, stoned, excited, turned on, fucked up, and generally crazed. But it was a happy kind of insanity. Greg Hartman was going to be president. He was going to kiss it and make it better. For the Jokers and all the other poor damned souls in the park. Camelot was just around the corner. Jay wondered how they'd feel the morning they all woke up and realized that somehow Camelot had turned into Mordor.
I want to go back to the hotel,
Blaze whined yet again.
This is boring.
Hey, Jay told him. This is history in the making. Look around, taste it, smell it. Blaze sniffed the air suspiciously.
That's just beer, he said. Beer and piss.
Jay had to laugh. That sounded like one of his lines. Maybe you'll make a PI yet, kid.
I am tired of all these stupid jokers, Blaze said. You should let me mind control them. I bet they're just lying to you. I bet they all know Sasha. I could make them tell us.
No, Jay said. When we find Sasha, you can take him. Make him tell me the truth. That's all. They found Doughboy all alone in the field, playing with a manhole cover. He was throwing it like a frisbee, flinging it 20-30 yards across the grass, then scrambling after it to throw it again. It didn't fly as well as a frisbee, but Doughboy didn't seem to mind. There was nothing but innocent, childlike joy on his great round face. But when Jay called out, the Joker stopped and looked guilty. We're looking for Sasha, Jay asked him. He used to work at the Crystal Palace. Have you seen him anywhere? Doughboy slowly shook his head from side to side.
I was just playing, he said.
Blaze laughed.
I know a good game he can play,
he said. Doughboy's face went waxen, and he began to take off his clothes with thick, clumsy fingers. Jay swung around. Let him go, he snapped.
Why should I? You can't make me.
Jay slapped him. Blaze stood there, his eyes hot with anger, his cheek as red as his hair, and for a second, Jay was afraid of what he might do. Then suddenly, he looked away.
Okay, he mumbled. I'm sorry.
All right, Jay said after a long moment. It's forgotten. Come on. Sasha's still out there somewhere.
How did you find me here? Brennan asked, fade out. Wait, don't tell me, he added before the ace could say anything. Lazy dragon.
Very astute,
fade out said sarcastically.
He lost you when you were grabbed by the police, but he picked you up again at the church by running down your usual haunts.
And you followed me here.
Quite right,
fade out looked around.
You do know the most interesting people.
He reached over and picked up Chrysalis's journal.
But this is what I've come for. This will give me more power than Chrysalis ever had, because I won't be reluctant to use the information.
Brennan couldn't believe that he'd come so close to finding what he needed, only to have it snatched away at the last moment. He made a move to reach for Fade Out, but the ace swung his gun up and pointed it at Brennan's midsection.
Wouldn't want me to have to shoot you,
he asked, as the miniature Chrysalis moved. She'd been standing on the desk next to Fade Out, and as he pointed his pistol at Brennan, she leaped and grabbed it by the barrel. Fade Out looked at her in shock as her weight dragged the barrel toward the floor. He cursed and shook the gun, but she wouldn't let go. As Brennan shouted, "No!" he pulled the trigger. The shot echoed loudly in the confined chamber. The bullet ripped the miniature Chrysalis off the barrel and sent her flying through the air. She spattered against Mother like a broken rag doll. Mother made no sound, but extruded long, human-like arms that cuddled the broken body against her mattress of flesh. Brennan kicked the gun from Fadeout's hand, and with the same smooth motion, backhanded him across the face and snatched the diary. Fadeout went down, blood from his crushed lip dribbling on his chin. He put a hand to his mouth to wipe it away and mumbled,
You're dead now, you bastard.
And threw something at Brennan. It hit his chest and bounced onto the desktop. It looked like a carved bit of potato. Brennan backed away as the potato expanded, taking on black bands of fur, a large, chubby body, and a round, funny face with big black circles on its eyes. The giant panda grinned at him. It was cute as hell with its fat, furry body and comical face. It was also twice Brennan's weight and had formidable talons and bright, sharp, shining teeth.
"Kill him, dragon,"
Fadeau directed. The panda made a whining, bleeding noise and carefully climbed off the desk and advanced on Brennan as the homunculi ran screaming and skittering from the chamber. There was no way Brennan could hope to defeat the thing, and it was between him and the door. The only factor he had on his side was superior speed. The damn roly-poly panda couldn't be as fast as him, he hoped. He backed up further into the chamber, and the panda padded after him, a stupid grin on its amiable, clownish features. When Brennan could go no further, it reared up on its hind legs and growled as if a buzzsaw were rumbling deep in its throat. Brennan moved. He tried to dodge around the creature, but the bastard was fast, damn fast. Brennan felt a surge of agony rip through his left arm as the panda swung a huge paw and caught him squarely on the forearm. Brennan felt bones break and flesh tear, but he was by the panda and running. Fadeout had faded, but his eyes were still visible, so he could see. He tried to stop Brennan, but Brennan stiff-armed him and knocked him on his ass as he skidded by and went out into the tunnel. He looked to the left where the sewer line lay, and then to the right, which led to a stepladder to the basement of the Crystal Palace. Brennan didn't want to be trapped in the underground tunnel. He had to go up. He caught his breath at the pain that lanced through his arm. Both bones in his forearm were broken. The radius had ripped through his flesh, and blood spurted in time with the pulses of agony surging up his arm. Brennan breathed deeply and rhythmically to get the pain under control as he ran down the corridor and grabbed the ladder leading up to the basement. He glanced over his shoulder and saw the panda coming down the corridor a lot faster than he thought possible. He transferred the journal to the crook of his injured arm, groaning as the torn flesh and broken bones took its weight, and fumbled in his hip pocket. He took the transmitter from his pocket, activated it. "Crystal Palace," he croaked. He dropped it as he pulled himself up the ladder with his good hand. The trapdoor at the top of the ladder resisted his efforts at first, but opened when he banged his good shoulder against it, sending waves of agony pounding down his injured arm. Brennan pulled himself into the storeroom and slammed the trapdoor back down. A flight of rickety wooden stairs went up to the first floor, and Brennan took them at a run, bursting into a corridor that led to the palace's restrooms. A woman going down the corridor toward the bathrooms took one look at Brennan, bloody-faced and with the radius of his right arm sticking out of his flesh like a jagged spear stub, and screamed. Brennan bolted past her and burst into the taproom of the Crystal Palace. Everyone stared at him. No one tried to stop him as he plowed into the taproom, but the press of customers formed a blockade that Brennan couldn't push through. There came another piercing scream from the hallway, and Brennan knew that Lazy Dragon was still on his trail, and he didn't have the problem that Brennan did. Lazy Dragon simply crashed through the crowd, scattering it like screaming tenpins. Brennan, knowing he wasn't going to outrun the panda, turned with his back against the bar, his right arm an agonizing hunk of dead meat hanging from his shoulder. The smart customers were leaving. The slow, the curious, the drunk, and the stupefied stayed to watch as the panda closed on Brennan, his cute little face grinning a grin that exposed razor-sharp teeth, capable of biting off an arm with a single chomp.
"Give me the book,"
Fadeout commanded from behind the bear, but Brennan shook his head.
"Take it,"
Fadeout ordered, and the panda advanced like slow, inescapable doom. Brennan gathered himself for a final attempt to escape as the panda shuffled forward on his hind feet. He feinted to his left, quickly shifted low and to the right, and almost scooted away. Almost. The ace slammed a paw down across Brennan's back, and it felt like the ceiling had fallen on him. Brennan dropped to his knees, with the breath squeezed from his lungs, rolled, and came to his feet right in front of the panda. The ace slapped the journal away from him, as easily as taking candy from a child, and Fadeout retrieved it.
"Finish the job," he told Dragon.
The remaining spectators crowded as best they could to the edges of the room.
Leave him alone.
The unexpected voice sounded calm in the hushed silence, and oddly gentle. The panda turned slowly, one gigantic paw still raised and ready to smash Brennan to jelly. The squat, hunchback figure had materialized in the open area between the onlookers and Brennan and the panda. Dragon, his eyes on Quasiman, swatted at Brennan, who took the blow on his shoulder and managed to roll with it a little. He smashed against the bar with a jolt that brought tears to his eyes. Somehow he managed to pull himself to his knees and say, "We need the journal," before collapsing in agony. Quasiman advanced slowly, dragging his stiff left leg behind him.
"Give me the book," he told Fade Out,
and as he switched his attention to Fade Out, the panda charged. It struck Quasiman like a runaway train smashing into a cliff face. The two hurtled backward into the screaming spectators. It was a miracle that no one was crushed as Dragon's momentum crashed them both through the wall. Wood shattered and pipes burst, and a spray of water showered the room. Brennan pulled himself to his feet as they came crashing back through the hole they'd made in the wall, the panda first, Quasiman after him. Quasiman lifted a heavy wooden table and battered his foe. His first blow crushed the panda flat on the floor, shattering the table to kindling. The panda got to his feet and charged at Quasiman, smashing him through the bar and into the large mirror and racks of bottles behind. Lupo deserted his post with a despairing yowl as mirror and bottles burst into a million scintillating shards. Brennan swayed on his feet, undecided. He wanted to help Quasiman, but realized there was nothing he could do against Dragon. He wanted to follow Fade Out, but the ace had already managed to disappear in the dark room filled with running, screaming people. Dragon and Quasiman smashed through the bar again and rolled about the floor like angry behemoths, punching and kicking and clawing one another. The panda had blood on his fur. Brennan wasn't sure whose, and Quasiman's shirt had been ripped off his back, exposing the mass of bone and flesh that was his hump. Brennan's nose twitched at a sudden foul smell in the air. It was gas. Natural gas. The battling aces had broken a gas line as well as the water line when they'd smashed through the wall. Brennan had a moment of calm, coherent thought, realizing that everyone had to get out before a spark ignited the gas that had seeped into the room. He turned to shout to everyone to leave, but it was too late. There was a muted, whooshing roar, and flames blossomed near the shattered wall. Someone yelled, "Fire!" and the pandemonium was complete. There was a panicked flight toward the door. Some were trampled, but cooler heads somehow dampened the frenzy. Brennan realized that it would be impossible to force his way through the crowd, so he headed to the stairway that led to the exits on the upper floors. He paused at the foot of the stairs and watched Quasiman and Dragon waltz around the floor in a clumsy dance. The panda's paws were on Quasiman's shoulders, and Quasiman had his hands locked around the animal's throat. Its snarling, spitting face was only inches from Quasiman's. "Quasiman!" Brennan's voice cut through the panic like a bullhorn through fog. "Break it off! Quasiman!" He never knew if the Joker heard, whether he decided he'd had enough, or whether his brain slipped off, wandering God alone knew where. Quasiman suddenly vanished, teleporting away just as the panda snapped its jaws shut in a bite that would have taken Quasiman's face off. It groped around in bewilderment for its vanished foe and staggered into a pillar of flame suddenly shot from the hole it had helped pound in the wall. The air was suddenly speared by the scent of burned fur, and the panda tottered about, spreading the fire as it bumped into the shattered bar and the broken furniture that littered the floor. It finally